everyone. So I'd like to call our May 3rd meeting of Health, Human Services, and the Housing Committee to order. And I'll begin by entertaining a motion to approve the April 3rd, 2023 meeting minutes. Do I have a motion to discuss?
I'll make a motion.
Second. Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Before we get into resolutions, we have two guests that are, we're going to give a little bit of time at the beginning of the meeting. We had hoped to have these for April, but we had so many resolutions for April that we figured May would be lighter. It wasn't, it isn't, tonight is a pretty full agenda. So I just ask that we keep our comments concise. We'll try and do no more than 10 minutes for each person, and we'll ask some questions if we have any. And legislators are also welcome to follow up with folks afterwards, so we don't have to feel pressured to have every question answered tonight. The first guest is Susan Baxter, who is the Executive Director of the Ulster Prevention Council. Thank you so much. If you want to give us a little bit of an overview of the Prevention Council, and we'll go from there.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. So for time purposes, I'm going to go really quickly through what we do. So the Ulster Prevention Council does school-based and community-based prevention. We teach evidence-based programming in 7 of the 9 school districts in Ulster County. Primarily, we teach Too Good for Drugs and Too Good for Violence, depending on what the school needs are. Currently, we're in Saugerties, New Paltz, Rondout, Walk Hill, Highland, Marlboro, and Ellenville. The only district that we are doing Too Good for Violence in is Ellenville at this point. They had asked for that for like a 15-week session. So the program is a 10-week session that we push into either a social studies, science, or PE class, health, because it aligns with the curriculum of New York State curriculum. So we push into those classes, stay for 10 weeks, and then leave and do like follow-ups after that, and then go to the next school. And so we kind of, with our educators, we have two, so they like piggyback each other. So we may do certain districts in the fall, and then the rest of the districts in the spring, because we certainly couldn't manage it all at once. With these school districts, all that I mentioned are K through high school. The only high school that we teach in is Rondout, where we do 9th and 10th grade Too Good for Drugs. Everything else is either elementary level or middle school level, and elementary would be starting at 4th grade, and we typically end at 8th grade. So it just depends on the school, whether they're elementary or middle school. So we currently serve about, the last I looked, it was about 1,800 to 1,900 students in Ulster County with these programs. So that's school-based. With community-based, we do a program called Teen Intervene, which is for mild to moderate substance use. With that, we get referrals from all of the school districts or from outside community sources, which would be probation, or it can be a parent referral, which we've been recently getting parent referrals for that program. It's a 3-week program where, you know, it's only for mild to moderate if it's outside the moderate, or if, you know, we indicate that it's, you know, something beyond what we can handle, we refer them out for treatment. Additionally, we do Girls Circle, or we also call it the Circle to be more inclusive. So we do that for after school, where we deal with, you know, body image, friendships, things like that. So we keep those to about 8 to 9 students, and that goes all through all of these districts that I'm talking about. All of these programs go into these school districts. I feel like I'm under a... okay, so then with the community, we also do parent engagement nights in the school districts. So New Paltz, Marlboro, Kingston High School, Bailey Middle School, and Miller Middle School, which is coming up. We do a hidden in plain sight, which is the mock teen bedroom, so parents can walk through and see like stash where kids would stash things, things of that nature, and we kind of just educate parents, you know, what's going on with, you know, where kids can put things like that. And then we also do a current drug trends, and that would be whatever's happening at that moment. So it's constantly changing for us and what we see within the community or what we hear through the students, things of that nature. So we do that in all of those districts that I mentioned. It's typically from 6 to 8 at night. The districts ask for us to come in, so we go in and do that. And with that, the parents can, learn more about what's happening in the county, what's going on with, overdose rates. We can direct them to, different websites, things like that. We also do what's called crash courses in these school districts. So if we're not in a school where we're teaching a evidence-based program, they'll ask for us, like Bailey Middle School asked to come in and just do teach 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade all PE classes, a THC and vaping lessons. So all of those grade levels received the same information, so that went on for about a week. And when we did the vaping and THC, so that went on for the week, and then the week after we did the parent engagement night. So it kind of worked hand in hand with the students, and then the parents heard the same information. So we did like those crash courses that I say in Bailey, New Paltz, and Marlboro. Rondout, we do restorative justice there. So if a student, let's say something happens on the bus or there's some sort of, issue with social media, we'll come in and work with them to do restorative justice to kind of turn it around and, do something better. Could be something on the radio through Rondout, things of that nature. We are also working, we have the SOAR grant, which is provides for Teen Intervene, so that's something that we're working on. We're coming into the SOAR 3 funding, so we'll be pushing through with Teen Intervene, trying to get more referrals for that program. I think.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Just one. So the reason you're not in some school districts is that you have to be invited in, and those school districts have not invited you?
Right. So a few years in, 2000, whatever, we were in Bailey and Miller middle schools for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and that went on for a few years, and then it kind of fizzled out for a little bit. And then Onteora is the only other one we're not in, Kingston Onteora.
The county school districts are really divided between your program and families' adolescent program, so we're doing the middle schools. We're in four districts. We share some districts. There's a big catchment.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate
you.
It. And you would not be faulted for not sticking
Are you sure? Like, walk of shame out of here.
I know a lot of folks can attest that I say that every time.
Okay.
Every time I say that. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
All right. Our next guest is from Family of Woodstock, the executive director of Family of Woodstock, Michael Berg. And Michael, if you want to join us or whatever you want to do.
Is that all right?
Yeah, please. Yeah, absolutely. And I know our invitation to you grew out of a request from Legislator Erner, and he shared some questions ahead of time with you, and I know that you have those. But I welcome you to give us whatever overview or answer whatever questions you would like to, again, with the intention of staying 5 or 10 minutes to the best that we can.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the first thing on this top is responses to the questions that you asked. There was a question as to whether we give breakfast. In point of fact, at the Darmstadt shelter. In point of fact, we give a cold breakfast that includes bagels, donuts, muffins, fruit, cereal, and pastries. We do not cook a warm breakfast. However, St. Joseph Church brings a warm breakfast 5 days a week that includes sandwiches, French toast, etc. As for the rest of the food, we're very fortunate, at least so far, that we have a terrific cook. We do a buffet style. There's a huge amount of food. We showed you some pictures. Any of you would be welcome to come at 12 o'clock. There's a lot of food, and both for dinner as well. Second question was about 7 a.m. in breathalyzers. This dates back to when we opened the original shelter. You may remember that DSS required that as part of it, that there was a work and a housing search requirement. The way that we structured the shelter is that the night shift does the meds at 7 o'clock in the morning before they leave. That works well for us. At that time, we also breathalyze people because we are trying to maintain a clean and sober shelter. That was the way that it has been done up until the pandemic, when the DSS gave up, or seems to have given up, the work requirements. So we still maintain that the night shift in our shelter should do the meds. People are breathalyzed, they can go back to bed. Breakfast is available all morning, but the St. Joseph's comes at between 7 and 8. Third question. Cleanliness. I want to say something, and I don't mean... the Don shelter's per diem is $122.50 a night. That's $7.50 less than you are paying the roadway currently, although you're going to stop, but other, which are $130 a night. So that's without any food or services. The county has committed. The reason that happened, there was no negotiations last year. The county executive was running for Congress. But the county has committed that they will increase the per diem. The per diem has to increase. One of the things that happened for us is we've been criticized as why we don't pay a decent wage. In January of 22, we gave a 6 2/3 raise. It was the biggest raise we had ever given by a lot. It didn't help us at all. It didn't increase the number of people that came to work for us. In July, given that the 8% inflation, we gave another 6 2/3% raise. We have filled most of our positions, which was my greatest concern. But it also means that the county, that the family is carrying a significant deficit. And I want to tell people, because I don't think you know this, out of all of Families 22 programs and all of our administration and our total budget of $14,000, the county represents 11%. It's not a lot. It's not enough. Most of the money that we bring into the county, we brought in through grant writing. Wouldn't have come to the county. At least $6 million a year. But now, as we're forced to pay more and more for salaries, 10 years ago, the percentage of our overall budget that was government-driven was 85%. It's below 73 now. It isn't that we got smaller, we got significantly bigger. It's that the government does not increase what it pays for things. So we have contracts that are 5, 6, 7 years old that have never been increased. I'm not saying that's only the county, but the county may have to help us. All right, so having said that, we're designed to be in a long-term emergency shelter. The impact of the pandemic was to increase the length of stay from 33 days to 55 days. That's an increase of 167%. What happened is that people who are homeless gather their stuff to themselves. So they don't like people going around them. They don't like people looking through them. And so when you have 4 people that are total strangers in a room, and they're going to be there for 55 days, and they accumulate stuff, it gets very messy. We have no leverage to ask people to clean. We ask them, but we cannot enforce it. And we haven't had the money to clean everywhere ourselves, and even if we did, the clients would not be happy with us cleaning their rooms. So that's unfortunately a reality. We have had issues with clients not bathing. We have even put somebody out because we couldn't get them to bathe for a month, and the people in the rooms were complaining. And so I want to just point out what it's like to run a congregate homeless shelter. People don't know each other. They're strangers and they're distrustful. So it's a hard program. It was very hard to run during the pandemic. Having said that, I did give you, and I wanted you to look at, I also gave you the outcomes of Darmstadt Shelter for 22, of the Family Inn for 22, of our domestic violence shelter, of our runaway program, and the agency as a whole. I think that if you want to understand what we do, these are good places. And I want to point out that while there are people that don't want to go to the shelters, and I understand that, but understand that the people that go to the shelters go to the doctor. They go to the dentist for the first time. They get mental health counseling. They get substance abuse. They deal with their criminal justice stuff. And they get housing. Not a lot, not in the last couple of years, but in answer to your question, Phil, about emergency housing vouchers, we do all of them in the county. Every person that goes through our shelters, except for the teens, are told about it. We have filled out over 100 applications with people, and we found people more than 25 houses, which is amazing in this environment. So that answered those questions. I was given a whole list of questions, which I'll run through if you let me.
Sure.
Yep. First one was...
Can I just say, any questions that you're answering, I do want them to... I want you to direct them to me as the chair.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was a question about... Could we improve the transition between DSS and us? And I have to say, the relationship and the work that our staff and DSS is doing is phenomenal. We're on the phone to each other all day long. I couldn't ask for more. You know, it hasn't always been that way, but since it's been really hard, DSS has stepped up and we have stepped up. There's a lot of work involved in putting people in motels. And just so you know, we put, through the first week in April, the agency put $411,000 in motel bills out. That's huge. $122,000 in a month. That's what's really going on. And there isn't motels. There is no motels. We're going to be sending people out of the county for the foreseeable future because, I mean... We find a few, but there's always more people that are needing it right now. So that is a problem. I know the county is working on it as tremendously, and Commissioner every day calls me with another idea or another thing he's trying. But we really are in a desperate situation, and it doesn't feel like it's going to change anytime soon. Part of the contract with DNS, do I tell the emergency housing? Yes, we do that. We and the DSS play the same room rates. It may have been different years or a while ago when the DSS had special rates. That's not the case anymore. I have with families temporary housing clients denied motel accommodations. What leverage does family have to negotiate with the motels independent of DSS? None. The only thing that's going on is because we pay better than the county, the motels would rather do business with us. And that's put us in a bind because we've outlaid a lot of money. And there are processes going on. And before the legislature, I believe, in a couple of weeks, you will be asked to change a contract because the Code Blue contract didn't call for us to put $400,000 worth or $370,000 worth of motel bills out.
So, could I just ask for clarification? So there's a standard rate of pay or family does pay more?
We don't pay more.
You do not pay more.
I don't believe
faster.
We do.
I think Michael meant to say pay faster.
Pay faster. Oh,
not better.
Okay.
We pay faster.
Okay, definitely faster.
Okay,
thank you.
Yeah, I'm
thank
sorry.
Thank you for clarifying. Yeah.
I have the same question.
Yeah, okay. So they pay for yeah.
What are the policies and procedures at these facilities, such as rehousing plan? You know, we work on housing every day, and we know virtually every apartment that opens up. But... not every apartment will take our people. Most of them don't have the money to pay. I know that this is impossible, and I know what I'm about to say is, but I just have to present this to you to think about. You're leaders of one level of government. You're paying $3,000 to put a person in a motel for a month. That person could... If they could get $400 of rental assistance, they could get housing. We could save $2,600 a person. It's a huge amount of money. And not all of it goes to the county by any means. In fact, most you don't pay that much of the housing bill. But it's a system that's broken. And so it's very frustrating when you're on the front lines of that system to see what's really happening and that it really isn't working. I'm sorry, but I just need to say that. What, if any, safety and health inspections of emergency housing motels does family do? We have no capacity to do that. We barely have capacity to run the programs we're doing. Does family have storage? We have no storage. In fact, there's been a lot of times when people would like to give us furniture. They'd rather give it to a, you know, I get a call, I have a house full of furniture, my aunt just died, can you pick it up and take it? And I want to, because I know that we're going to put 25 people in apartments that don't have furniture. But I don't have it. I cajole Tom Cesare to give me a container, and that's what I have. And it's not enough. Has Ulster County Food Security, that's a project similar to the COC for food. The county gave us a grant of $25,000 to organize it. We've had our first meeting. The second meeting has been scheduled. We're doing a survey. It's different than the COC in that there's 53 pantries alone. So it's not something you can bring everybody to. But we're surveying them, and we have a board that's working. And we're waiting for the county to release the RFP for the ARP food money, because there's a lot of shortages in the food programming that's going on right now. We've been providing the Kingston Emergency Food Cooperative 150, now I just was told it was 182 meals a day, full dinners, and we're in deficit. There was a time when the COVID money paid for that, but the COVID money is gone. And so now we have to try and figure out what we'll do to continue that, or if we can continue it. But
the COC is?
Continuum of care. It's the equivalent for housing.
Thank you.
How many workers do you employ? I don't know how many workers that we employ, but there aren't that many that you actually employ. You may pay a portion of a match, but, you know, there's restorative justice is one where you pay, but there aren't that many that the county pays per se, but they pay a portion of, as I said, 11% of our overall budget. What types of, all of them are either case managers or they're the supervisors of case managers. Our entry level for a case manager has now been raised to $17.60 an hour. When the state says that it's going to raise the minimum wage, it scares me because they don't raise their contracts. And it's just not right. And I could show you a lot of contracts that that's true.
I think the last couple of questions are pretty big topics. I don't know that we have time to get into them.
I understand, but I would like to just respond.
Yeah, in conclusion, perhaps.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think that family does a really good job in almost every area that we do. We are not looking to expand into areas that we are not the lead, but we do feel like we can make a huge contribution in the areas that we're the lead. I count those as homelessness, domestic violence, restorative justice, child care certainly, our adolescent services programs. Those are areas where, and criminal justice, those are areas where I hope to have more support from the county because I think we could do a better job. And I think that the county really needs to look at the fact that you have tremendous resources, more than almost any county in Kingston. You have virtually nothing in Ellenville, very little in New Paltz, nothing in Shandaken. Yesterday they released ALICE. ALICE is an analysis of the poverty level and the condition of population in the community. Shandaken had the highest number at 48%. We need to be able to deliver services where people are. We can help do that. We have offices in New Paltz. We have offices in Ellenville. We would like to help do that. that's needed. And I know that the county executive has said that she's committed to bringing services to other parts of the county. I think it's really important, especially important now because the pandemic has impacted on our society in a lot of ways that aren't really positive. We're seeing it in terms of our youth. And I believe we could help with that.
Perhaps that's a good note that we can end on. I really appreciate it. I was going to open questions, but if it's all right, I'll ask folks to follow up. Michael, are you comfortable with us sharing
sure.
your contact information? Just because we're already at the half an hour point. And
my cell phone, which is the best way to reach me, is 845-663-7408. If you have specific questions, it's probably best to email me at mberg@FOW, which stands for Family of Woodstock, INC.org. I will respond. Maybe not immediately.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Really appreciate it. Thank you for everything that you do in the community.
Thank you.
And similar to our prior guest, you don't have to stay for the whole rest of the meeting.
No, no, I want to eat. Thank you all.
You did print out pictures of food for us.
Yeah.
We're flying to eat now. All right.
Bye-bye.
So with that, we can move into our resolutions. We're going to take a couple of them out of order because we have some of our department heads that only have one resolution. We have another that has another contract agency that has a commitment. So we're going to take first the Office for the Aging resolution. So resolution number 277, approving the execution of a contract amendment for $25,000, causing the aggregate contract plus amendment amount to be in excess of $50,000 and to by the county with Jewish Family Services of Ulster County, Office for the Aging. Can I have a motion to discuss?
So moved.
And second. A second. All right. Moved by Petit, second by Nolan. And I will give the floor to Director Copenhaver for just to give us a quick overview.
So Jewish Family Services is our subcontractor for our enhanced case management consultant. And what she does is when we have a case that's getting close to being appropriate for Medicaid, she works with the folks to get their paperwork together, especially if they're really not able to do it, and helps and works with Medicaid to get them approved so they can actually get services that they need. So she tends to work on maybe 5 to 7 cases at a time at all varying degrees of where they are in the Medicaid application process. And she's very good at it. She's been doing it for a very long time. We've had this contract for a long time. It's just a kind of a standard addition for the next year.
Great, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Any discussion? All right, if there's no further discussion, we'll call a question on Resolution 277. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that's unanimous. Thank you. You are welcome to leave.
Thank you.
Next, we are going to review the resolution that is contracting with Samadhi. David is here with us and has a prior commitment at 6, so I wanted to make sure that we had the chance to include him in the conversation. So with that, resolution number 273, approving the execution of a contract for $797,000 entered into by the county with Samadhi Center, Inc., Department of Mental Health. Can I have a motion to discuss?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Stewart, second by Erner. And I'll defer first to Deputy Executive Contreras or Commissioner McDonald, if you want to.
Sure. So we were fortunate enough to be the recipients, at least of the first round of opioid settlement funds, so that we can start to not continue to tackle the opioid epidemic here in Ulster County. With the county put out an RFP in late 2022 or early 23, I'm sorry, but we reviewed it in early 23, and we asked for some projects that would help us to be able to really support our residents that are challenged with substance use disorders and specifically opioid use disorder. In the RFP, there were a number of different areas that someone could choose to work on: prevention, housing, data, and treatment and we received, I think, 12 different RFPs, and we came on to two providers that we wanted to be able to support in four different projects. Somati would be holding three of those projects. One is a expansion of their substance use outpatient disorder that is licensed by OASAS to provide, provide outpatient treatment in order to be able to reduce use of substances. The other one is actually quite exciting and innovative. It is the only outpatient detox that would be in our region. As you guys know, we have no more inpatient detox beds at Health Alliance. They won't be bringing them back. The closest that we have is in Poughkeepsie. But also, this is a different way of us looking at detox and being able to determine what is the appropriate level of detox that is needed for someone. It's medical support. It's community support. It is giving them peer support. And it's also allowing for them to be able to maintain their home, to maintain their lives while trying to be able to detox off of these substances. It's really quite innovative, so we decided we wanted to support that. And then the third one for Somati is to support their Somati Refuge, which is providing emergency housing in Saugerties for 28 individuals. And the support that we're giving to that is to be able to bring on additional SERPAs, which are certified peer recovery peer advocates, to not just give individuals housing in an emergency, but also to be able to provide them ongoing peer support in order to look at all areas of their life. And when they are transitioning out of the emergency housing and going into the community, they would really be able to sustain that level. And also to purchase a car, I believe. So we're the refuge is working. We're not necessarily going to be helping with the ongoing sustainability, but we're bringing on the support so that folks can sustain their recovery or be willing to consider recovery through harm reduction activities and getting the support from the surface. So that's the three projects with Somati. And then the final one is with Ellenville Regional Hospital. And we're just trying to be able to develop a response to overdoses in the community. Right now, the sheriff's office and Oracle and his high-risk mitigation team have a level of response that they are doing when they get in, because law enforcement gets those incidents, and they're responding to them. What we're hoping to be able to do is to charge Ellenville Regional Hospital with looking at our system as a whole so that we can work together collaboratively in developing a protocol so that it's not just the sheriff's office. Even right now, the sheriff does include the Department of Mental Health in some of these intentional overdoses, but there's got to be a way that is more seamless, and we can be working together in the community, not just one person taking over while one step of it is gone, but we're looking for that protocol to really be collaborative from the beginning. So Ellenville Regional Hospital will be bringing on a specialist to help us through that journey, and that's all for the project.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Carol. That was very thorough. And the only other thing I'll add, just to contextualize the round of funding, this is just the first round. There's also another, so this is around $1 million for this round. There's another $1 million that we're also in the planning stages for. And then there's another million, the second one is through OASAS directly from the state. There's another $1 million that we'll be getting next year from three pharmacies. So this is not the last. There's continuous funding for this work, and that will continue to go.
Thank you. Legislator Petit.
Thank you. So in the Somati contract, it says they're planning on renting space at 368 Broadway. And, you know, the concern is because when we were out there advocating for the center, for the stabilization center, it's right across from the high school. Is this program going to be different than the one that was at the Clinton Avenue Church? Okay. So if that's the case, then that's one.
Yeah.
Through the chair.
Yep. So yeah.
And then the other part of it is, I see in here it says when Somati can bill. So is there additional certification? Is there anything that we can do to kind of expedite that so that they'll be able to bill as an organization?
Sure.
Sure.
So I'd like to recognize David McNamara as the head of Samadhi to help us answer these questions. Thank you.
Absolutely. So to address the first question, so this is at 368 Broadway. We currently have an outpatient clinic, and this is a Oasis 822 outpatient clinic. It is not the Samadhi Outreach Center, which was on Clinton Avenue, which is now in the building that we own on 150 Soquel. It's a very different type of program. The outpatient clinic is just like step one or Ridgeback in regards to it has all the rules and regulations of a Oasis out 22 outpatient clinic. And we've been operating since October in that space.
And then just to clarify the question, this is different than the type of service that was being provided on Clinton Avenue.
Yes, completely. Yeah. The type of service that was being offered at Clinton Avenue is now being offered at 150 Soquel Road. In town of Boston.
Yep. Does that answer your question, Legislator?
Yeah. And then the billing question. Is there a way to expedite that? That what is that through Oasis? We'll have to look at.
So I can answer that. We've been in the credentialing process for about 3 months. So we're probably we're starting to get credentialed by Medicaid and by payees. So we are in the process of billing. We can back bill for 90 days, so we are billable now. More and more insurance companies will be credentialing us in the coming 2 months.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Yeah, Legislator Erner.
I saw somewhere in here the 122 Clinton Avenue location reference that didn't seem like it was an old thing, but do you still have any presence there at all whatsoever?
No, we don't.
Okay. My other question, so as an advocate for the people of the county, and this might be for Commissioner McDonald as well, how do you see the people going through the county government to get access to Samadhi through all the what this program would be? Or do the people call Samadhi directly, or how's this all going to work?
They could call anywhere, but they can call Samadhi directly. We are really working quite hard through our integrated ulcer initiative so that there's no wrong door. So they could literally, because this regional outpatient detox is nowhere else within the region, if they wanted to call step one and ask for it, step one should be able to refer there, right? It really is no wrong door. Certainly they can call the department. We go through these conversations with folks to try and be able to steer them towards the most supportive and correct level of care for them, but they can go directly to Samadhi.
Yeah. And do I answer?
Technically you should direct your answers to me, and the questions should be directed to me as well. We try to cut down on the back and forth. So I
just want to say currently we're meeting 3 to 4 people a day. Those references are coming from Kingston Hospital, from Gateway, from Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital, from all of the rehabs. We are actually signing an MOU with Access Supports for Living across the hall, which would be referring all of their clients, and we refer our clients to them for mental health. Just to further answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions or points of discussion?
Yep. I just wanted to compliment the center on Clinton Avenue. David helped me recover from alcohol addiction 3 years ago this Friday.
Wow.
So you never know who's an addict in our communities, and David and Samadhi are amazing.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Any further discussion or questions about Resolution 273?
I'd just like to state that I'm going to recuse on this vote because I'm a volunteer president of the board of Samadhi.
All right, so with that, I'll call the question on 273. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? And one abstention, Legislator Nolan. So 273 is going to advance. Awesome. Thank you, David, for being here, and you're welcome to move on to your next agenda item, whatever that is tonight. next, we're going to take a couple of the resolutions that are regarding the planning department, because Dennis has a planning board meeting tonight. So that means the next resolution is going to be Resolution 288, approving the execution of a contract for $1,500,000 entered into by the county with RUPCO, the Department of Planning. Can I have a motion to discuss?
I'll move it.
Moved by Nolan, second by Petit. This is the contract for the budget amendment that we approved for the rental affordability upgrade program, which I'm very excited about. Thank you for bringing it this far. Is there anything, any framing that you want to provide, Director Doyle?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Oliver, much appreciated. Just quickly, we tried to be as true to the budget amendment that came through for us. So what you'll see in here is essentially a test of income levels in order to participate from the landlord perspective, from the tenant perspective. And then you'll also see in here the fact that there is a guaranteed portion of that property that would be rent restricted. And that rent restriction is at 80% AMI and for a certain amount of funding, and then at 60% AMI, that funding goes up. And the restrictions are generally anywhere between 3 to 7 years. We did do a request for proposals for this. RUPCO, we had two responses. RUPCO was the one that we chose. We do have a budget. I may be a little confusing in the contract, but the budget, total budget, is 1.5 million, of which the direct assistance is directed. I'm sorry, the RUPCO's project is about $260,000, which is less than 17%, about 17% of the total. That is what we normally see, actually less than we normally see for community development block grant funds in terms of the direct assistance and the administrative work with respect to that. Quite a bit of work goes into this, and so we're hoping for, we're only getting a lot of calls, so we're hoping for a very robust response when we roll it out.
Questions from the committee?
I mean, that question did come up,
yeah.
So because it's more than 10%, but you're saying that it's not the standard anymore? I'm sorry, to the chair, 10% is not the standard anymore. It's now 17?
So the Community Development Block Grant Fund, which is a state program which this legislature generally goes through, we currently have contracts with RUPCO, the maximum amount of administrative work, which includes all of the what they call program delivery and then program administration, that maximum amount is set by the state at 18%. In the conversations with RUPCO relative to what we're thinking about for when we started having a conversation about contracts, we were thinking that it needs to be less than that because it's a little less onerous when you're working with the county directly and not back through the state. We're going to use the same procedures that we use for community development block grant funds, which includes actual going out and scoping the work. In addition, I think it's important to note that RUPCO actually fronts the money, and then we reimburse RUPCO when we get the necessary documentation.
Mr. Leader, do you have a question?
Yes, two, please. Did Planner Doyle say that the tenants also will have to demonstrate income, not just the landlords of this program?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's actually the tenants. The landlords do not have to demonstrate income. The tenants have to demonstrate income, and that's typical with respect to that in terms of to be eligible. So you want to basically look at a demonstration income, and then the rents will be set on that basis.
Thank you. My second question, I saw a specific outreach to be done with the Latino community through Ulster County Hispanic Advisory Committee, and any other special, shall we say, outreach to other particular communities that are?
Well, there is a marketing plan in here, so we'll work with RUPCO to develop that marketing plan, but we're having a considerable amount of interest already with respect to this. One of the things we wanted to make sure that we did is get a geographic dispersion of this work. So my understanding, I believe, is when we put in this contract, we look at the various areas where we'd be working, and we're trying to scatter them about the county with some preferences for the disadvantaged communities.
Thank you.
And then if there aren't questions, other questions from the committee, I'll just ask, when I was reading through the program overview, when I submitted this budget amendment, it was inspired by a program that RUPCO had run in the past. The documentation I saw about that program, wasn't as specific here, so I realize this might just be a product of getting into the specifics, but I was surprised by how active a role RUPCO would play in actually, like, administering the contract with the contractors. I thought that this was something that could be a reimbursement that the property owner would be able to deal with their own contractors, but it sounds like RUPCO is really managing their contractors.
Well, and what ends up happening is the contract actually exists between the landlord and the contractor, but the scope of work and the management of that contractor is essentially by RUPCO. The big difference here between the program that was run previously, I believe we used enterprise funds, was they actually relied on pictures from landlords. So in order to make the determination in terms of funding, we didn't believe that that was adequate enough and protective enough of the county's and the public's money. So we went back through and said, we need you out on site to make sure that what's being asked to be done needs to be done, and B is when it's finished that it's done in the right way and that the apartment and or the house itself is upgraded. So that's why, and we do that right now for all of our community development block grant funding work. That's exactly what we use. And we use that model in that discussion with RUPCO.
Okay. My initial, like my personal reaction is that it seems very onerous and cumbersome. However, when I proposed this budget amendment, a lot of the feedback and criticism, constructive criticism, of course, from other legislators was around ensuring the validity of the repairs and you know, not standing in for the building inspector and all of these things. And I actually feel, while my inclination is to lower the barrier, a lot of the feedback that I got was to like ensure it's very stringent. So while I'm not in love with all of this, I think that I hope that our colleagues will be, because I know that there were concerns, so I hope that this addresses them. It also does explain a little bit the what I consider to be a high administrative cost, because it does sound like a lot of work that we're talking about here to go in and you know, kind of review these properties. So I'm comfortable advancing this, even though I wasn't too excited to see how intense of a process it was. But that's just my own personal feeling, and I thought that I would share that. Legislator Petit.
Thank you. I worked for RUPCO back in 2007 and 2008, so I understand that process. And you know, if say for instance a first time home buyer, they go out and they get, you know, so many estimates, and then basically what RUPCO is clerk of the works to make sure it's being done the right way, and then they sign off on the paperwork. So I think that really makes me very comfortable. If we could get them down to 10%, of course, that we'd have more money to put out. But I understand what you're saying, and we're paying for a service.
All right. Yeah, Legislator Erner.
Oh, thanks. This is just following up on my first question before. So we're in through this effort, we are asking tenants basically have to prove income so that the landlords can get the money to do. Something about that strikes me as bad, that we're, in other words, we, like, the building needs repairs, the landlord recognizes that, they're going to try and get the money for it. Okay, you tenants living here, you have to now reveal your income publicly somehow to this administrator so that I can get that money.
A central part of the program is that it's targeting a specific AMI. We would have no way to determine the AMI. Otherwise, I personally hate means testing, but otherwise, as long as we're talking about AMI, we have to pursue what the tenant's AMI, what their tenant's income is, unless they're known.
I think the tenants are going to receive the benefit from this. I mean, it is a benefit to the landlord as well, but the tenants are going to be living in a space that's better. And so, you know, I'd rather have the money go to the landlords that are serving these tenants than to landlords who don't have those tenants in their buildings. And that's really what we're able to do by asking for this information. Nobody has to do it. So it just, they won't, their building won't get those benefits, and they won't get those benefits,
well,
which helps keep their rent down,
yeah,
and it helps the environment, which I think helps everybody. So There is an odd character to it, but I think it works in this instance. And I hope that, I have no doubt that the tenants will support this. Because everybody that I know that I tell about a program like this, they want it for their building.
Yeah, and essentially, I mean, the fact that the affordable rent is built into it, I think, makes it, like, I always think of the kitchen table conversation. Can you sit at the kitchen table with them and explain it and feel good about how you're explaining it? And I feel like if you say this is going to make your rent, you're not going to have to pay, you know, more than 30% of your income for the next 3 years if they get the full amount, or, you know, whatever the breakdown is, I think that would be a pretty compelling pitch, even though I think it's a very uncomfortable process we'd be asking them to do. I think they would probably agree that it was worth it.
And I would just add the further comment that we need landlords to continue to provide housing in these types of spaces, and so this program helps stabilize that group of people who are doing this service in Ulster County.
I just wanted to mention something Legislator Sperry brought up about this in economic development yesterday, that we don't want tenants to be displaced because of the reconstruction, and I think Planner Doyle had a great point. Most of it will be projects like roofs or septics that won't force the person to move out.
All right, any other questions or points of discussion? So with that, we'll call the question on Resolution 288. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that was unanimous. And then next we have Resolution 289, approving the execution of a contract for $1.75 million entered into by the county with RUPCO, Department of Planning. Can I have a motion to discuss?
I'll move.
All right, moved by Nolan, second by Erner. And Director Doyle, if you want to give us just a very, very quick overview. And note, we did have the two resolutions for this last month as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that the legislature did approve the contract. So we're now working on, that's the contract with the state. This is just state money. So now we're working on the contract back with RUPCO. The important thing to note here is that it was a joint application that got funded between us, the City of Kingston, and RUPCO for that. And the thing that you can look at here relative to the difference here is, on this one is that it's the homeowner that actually has an income. We reach low and moderate income homeowners. And then the rent for the ADU can be anything. It's just an additional unit. What we're trying to do is, what the state's trying to do is essentially provide additional units and assistance to low and moderate income homeowners. So in this instance, we've just turned it around, and my apologies for saying that the wrong way the first time. In this instance, it's turned around, and now it's the homeowner himself or herself that essentially is one that has an income certification that's required in order to participate. The guarantee here is that, A, it has to be a long-term rental. You can't short-term rental it. And you also have a 10-year requirement on that person.
Any questions for Director Doyle? Points of discussion?
I thought it was fascinating that the contest will create the ADUs that people can just use without having to get specific approvals. Go ahead, if you want. Sorry, Chair.
So, yes, to the Chair, the answer, one of the things that got discussed at the Economic Development Committee meeting was that the City of Kingston is actually conducting a design competition for ADUs in the city, and that design competition will, when complete, those plans will be accepted by the Building Department and will be extended to be accepted by Building Departments elsewhere in the county, so that they would be stamped plans ready to go, that you wouldn't need any additional design work. And those are for standalone ADUs. So that's a really good thing. If I may go off topic a second.
For a second.
I just want to echo Michael Berg's comments with respect to the difficulties that nonprofits are having. The amount of stress and strain on the nonprofit system has really been incredible over the course of the pandemic, and it continues to be incredible because of the cost of things that have gone up, including the cost of labor. And the relief that needs to be sought needs to be thinking about it in a holistic standpoint. I know that some of the nonprofits, particularly with respect to some of the care systems, they were hoping for more money in the state budget. They didn't get it. But the labor force turns over quite significantly, and it's quite difficult to maintain an active and professional labor force. It really is a problem. Thank you for letting me do that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions or points of discussion on 289? All right. With that, I'll call a question on 289. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Excellent. Thank you so much. That's approved unanimously. Dennis, thank you for being here. And then the last resolutions that we'll take out of order, just we have two ones for the Department of Health that I think are going to be quick, so I figured we would just get those out of the way so Dr. Smith doesn't have to hang out for the other 70 resolutions that we have tonight. So with that, Resolution 275, authorizing the Chair of the Ulster County Legislature to execute an agreement with the New York State Department of Health, Bureau of Immunization, Department of Health. Moved by Nolan, and have a second. Second by Petit. Commissioner Smith, do you want to give us a quick overview of the...
The Immunization Action Plan grant is something we received through the New York State Department of Health. Its intention is to promote vaccination by way of education, education not only to the general public, but to providers about vaccination, to ensure that we have the optimum percentage of vaccination rates in the county, and so forth. It does not provide for the vaccine per se, but it provides to support the staff, the nurses in particular, who would go about to make sure that we are ensuring that our population is properly vaccinated.
Thank you. Any questions for the committee?
I saw a Merck ad recently about vaccinations, and it was very scary. And I was wondering who the education about the Immunization Action Plan will come from.
What is scary about it?
It was paid for by Merck, so I researched Merck and who owns Merck and how much money they were. And so the scary part was it seemed like World War II era propaganda where it was us versus them and we need to really crack down on them. And that it seems scary.
I just want to defer to Chair Uchitel. Is this a question, a comment?
Yeah, the question is...
we'll just keep consistent tonight. Direct the question to me if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. The question is... who will be the main educational body informing this campaign?
Yep. So the question is, who will be the main educational body informing the campaign?
We are the Education Department of Health, the nursing staff, and health educators in the department.
Sure, thank you.
Any other questions or points of discussion?
If there were concerns about any of the educational efforts, we could just get them back to the department and have that addressed.
If I could, there are immunization clinics in Ulster County. There used to be when my kids were little. That's where I took them. There was a Well Baby clinic, too.
Well, that was how many years ago?
A long time ago.
Yeah. So, obviously, medicine and healthcare has changed considerably over the past decade. We still do offer vaccinations through the Vaccine for Children program, for the underinsured or the uninsured. We do have participation in the Vaccines for Adults program for the similar population. We are currently administering the JYNNEOS vaccine for MPOX. We still do have some COVID vaccine in supply. But, you know, we really try to target the population that has no other access to these vaccines or they are, because of their insurance status, have difficulty in getting these vaccines. So we still do provide that.
Okay. All right. If there's no further questions or discussion, I'll call the question on 275.
Sorry, a quick question.
The
COVID vaccine that's in supply, I just added something to the resolution that we'll be discussing tonight, that there's new guidelines the CDC released on April 19th. They're no longer recommending any of the original vaccines that were monovalent mRNA, and I'm wondering if these are the original monovalent mRNAs.
No, we can only administer the bivalent by New York State regulation.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and if there's no further questions, which there can be if you want, then we'll call the question on 275. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that's unanimous. 276, authorizing the Chair of the Legislature to execute a contract and any amendments to the contract with New York State Department of Health to continue the Women, Infants, and Children program through the Department of Health. Can I have a motion to discuss?
So moved.
Second.
All right, moved by Stewart, second by Nolan. Commissioner Smith, if you want to give us a very brief overview.
Yeah, the WIPRS Women, Infants, and Children's Program is actually comes from, initially from the Federal Department of Agriculture, which basically supplies funding to the State Department of Health, which then subcontracts for WIC providers throughout the state. The county has been providing a WIC program now for, well, predates me, I don't know, 15 or more years, and the program is intended to support essentially breastfeeding and for moms, but we do offer vouchers and what have you for supplemental feed for infants, and we also do education and whatnot for the mother and child, the infant. But it is a grant program. It is renewable every 5 years by way of applying when the RFP is launched by the State Department of Health. We reapplied for the 50th, the consecutive 50-year cycle. We were awarded that grant, and we do have the WIC clinic in operation in Kingston. We do go out to Ellenville. We do have a site in Targetes that we go to. So the part of the WIC, which is a very prescriptive program, it specifies exactly what you need by way of staffing, nutritionists, et cetera. And it also stipulates that we do outreach to the county overall. So that's where we have the sites that we do go to during the course of the week to provide support to the individuals in those areas.
Thank you. Any questions or points of discussion? All right, then I will call the question on Resolution 276. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? And then I was gonna return back to the agenda in order, but then Deputy Clerk Mahler pointed out that we actually could potentially get the folks from mental health out of here. Everything else after that is Department of Social Services.
Bye.
Sorry.
I just have to say thank you. This is very considerate. Like, thank you.
Yeah. So why don't we do that? I think I believe it's just the two resolutions. There's the Ellenville Hospital, and then there was the ARPA one, right? Is that, Tara, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, cool. So let's do that. So that means the first one is going to be Resolution 217, amending Capital Project 598, Crisis Stabilization Center, amending the 2023 capital budget, closing costs for purchase of 368 Broadway through ARPA, Department of Finance, and Department of Finance Division of Recovery and Resilience. And I have a motion to discuss.
Move it.
Moved by Nolan, second by Pete, and Commissioner Feld, or I don't know. If
this is actually what Nate is here.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, this did go in front of the ARPA committee and has passed that far, but I definitely think this resolution is a little bit unusual, and I'm happy to express what's occurred. And I think the resolution itself, I was careful to make sure that it shows the progression of the different resolutions, because this was an additional amount that was needed to affect the purchase of 368 Broadway. So there was a resolution for $2 million, funding approval of $2 million, which was the purchase price of the building and the property. With closing costs, it came to approximately $56,000 above the $2 million. So it was challenging to find a way to make the closing happen. At this point, we have not, this is only technically, exceeded funding authority because we did have the $175,000 that was A&E services. So we have a total $2,175,000 currently for this project. But we fully understand that that $175,000 was an approval for the A&E services, and we absolutely have an obligation under contract to pay the contractor there. So we, hopefully this is proactive enough to bring this and to say we don't want an issue, and we're glad we were able to do, and the county attorney's office, I've met with them. I know they spent a month affecting this closing, which was complicated, being that it was a professional condominium association, and we did it. I'm happy to answer any questions, but that's the background.
Great, thank you so much. Any questions from the committee? Any points of discussion? So this is still coming from ARPA money.
It will be coming from ARPA money.
Once this is closed, I guess literally and everything else, then it's no longer ARPA money. It'll then get turned over to Public Works or Mental Health.
I can answer. So yeah. The project itself is being, as far as the Crisis Stabilization Center, is being led by Public Works. And a team within the county, but they are certainly leading like the renovations that are currently happening on the fourth floor and the design that, along with mental health, that is happening on the first floor. This specifically speaks to the closing.
Yeah, I believe that another way to answer that is perhaps this is the last time they'll have to go to the ARPA committee, and going forward they'll probably only come to our committee in ways and means. Or is that not the case? No.
No, because we still have renovation to do, and that will probably go through ARPA as
okay.
well.
Right.
But once the ARPA money is exhausted in terms of ongoing maintenance and staffing of the property, that is through DPW, and then mental health will be in the facility. That's where their offices will be, and then we'll have also providers in the building. So I think the answer to the question is yes. Moving forward, it'll be in the operating budget.
Okay. I think just to clarify that there's a lot in ARPA, and I thought ARPA was supposed to be basically, you know, where all of our buckets of funding went, and I feel like now they're clerk of the works for multiple projects, which is a lot for a department of three. And, you know, besides, and I'll speak for myself, but we're going to really be pushing now to get Elizabeth Manor finished because we need housing. And, you know, again, it's a lot for a department of three, along with water and sewer and, you know, a school mental health programs, and it's just, yeah.
Yes, no, I definitely agree. So ARPA team is wonderful, and they're managing the ARPA portions of it, but we do have DPW who are managing all the building-related parts of it, including the renovation, construction, and maintenance, and our mental health department is managing the operations side, so contracting with the provider. We have a special projects director who we're hopefully getting on board soon, who will be the lead on this project,
so
definitely there's a lot of help,
around
this project. Although the ARPA team is a critical part of it.
It's a lot for one department.
It is a lot for one department, yes.
I wanted to step in, and with this resolution, I think it's a little unusual because technically there was an overage on the $2 million funding authority, and so I just certainly wanted to make sure that for transparency that we're doing the right thing, that we didn't write into an issue. And so this, to me, is it's only $56,000 on one side, but it's also, I want to make sure that all the money is accounted for and as well, and that's a problem in the future contract.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. If there's no other questions or comments, then I will call the question on 217. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. That's great. Thank you so much. Resolution 274. Approving the execution of a contract for $74,985 entered into by the county with Ellicott Regional Hospital to
Department of Mental Health. Can I have a motion to discuss? Can I have a second?
Second.
All right. Moved by Corcoran, second by Nolan. Commissioner Dobbs, do you want to give us a very quick overview?
Absolutely. So I guess I erroneously previewed this earlier when talking about all four of the projects, but it's just in reiteration, it is for we chose Ellenville Regional, who is the leader in the rural health around the opioid epidemic, to help us to develop a protocol for overdoses in the community. They have the Sheriff's Department that is on board and actually signed a letter of support for them to take this on so that we could be working as one community in terms of responding to individuals that overdose on anything. Though it's opioid settlement funds, I really encourage whatever we develop to make sure that it's inclusive of anyone that is suffering from a substance use disorder.
Any questions?
I didn't have a question, I just had a comment.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I think it's great that we're working with Ellenville Regional Hospital on this. I think it's very important. As was mentioned earlier in the meeting, you know, that we spread these services around the county. So, kudos.
All right, any other comments, questions, or concerns? And I'll call the question on 274. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that was unanimous. Great. Thank you so much. Oh.
Can we actually do the CSB appointments just in case anybody has questions?
Sure.
Yeah, on the appointees, Walter is between her
that's
here.
Fine.
Sorry. Thank
no, that's
you.
That's totally fine.
270. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what number is this?
So these 270, are 271.
Just those two, actually.
Oh, just those
yeah,
two?
Yeah.
This,
oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a reappointment and two appointments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
70 to
72. 272
so
is community action.
So then why don't we just take them really quickly. Resolution 270, confirming reappointment of members to the Community Service Board, Board's Persons with Developmental Disabilities Subcommittee. Can I discuss?
So moved.
Moved by Nolan. Can I have a second? Second by Petit. Any questions, comments, or concerns? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. 271, confirming appointment of a member to the Community Services Board Substance Abuse Committee. Can I have a motion to discuss?
Move it.
Moved by Nolan. Can I have a second?
Second.
Second by Corcoran. Any questions, comments, or concerns? Point to discussion. I'll call the question on 271. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. That was unanimous. Here we go.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Now we are getting into the orders of the day. Resolution 126, dedicating funding to housing justice. Do you have a motion to
move? Do we want to take the director on those seats?
These are, they're all...
They should be quick.
I think there's a lot for them. I don't know that
okay.
This is going to be...
So a couple is not going to help you.
Yeah, I mean, then we would just have a few left. I mean, I guess we could...
I would favor that.
So now we're getting into the crazy period where all of a sudden everything gets really fast and crazy. Resolutions 222 through 264 are all contracts for early childhood. So
I make
like
a motion that we block those resolutions.
I'll second
yep.
that.
Excellent. That's 222 to 264. Is there any discussion on the act of blocking them? All those in favor of the act of blocking them?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. They're all blocked now. On the block.
222 to what?
264. Is there any discussion on the block? And maybe we can have just a very quick overview on the both the programs are.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. It's my pleasure to bring this evening to the meeting our Deputy Commissioner of Children and Family Services, Rita Wood, who's going to speak on these resolutions. Rita formerly was the Director of the Early Intervention and Preschool Program for Ulster County.
Without exaggeration, probably the person with the most expertise in our entire county on these programs and these contracts. So Rita, I would defer to you to just introduce the resolutions and answer any questions.
It's the preschool special education program. Our children 3 to 5 that have been identified through the county, through community services, through the school district that are in need of possible services. And it goes from an evaluation to actually a formal IEP or individual education plan. The state requires the county to contract for those services that are on the individual education plan, and that is what we do. And we have a 4-year contract. That this cycle is now into, we're renewing the contract. These providers provide everything. There's about 16 of them that provide evaluations and services, and the rest of them provide just services. And those services range from what we call related services only, meaning they only receive speech, OT, PT, counseling. Or there could be what they call special education itinerant teacher services, meaning that the 3 or 4-year-old would receive a special education teacher out in the community, maybe at Head Start or a UPK program, or possibly in their home if that's where their learning environment is. And then the biggest pieces of the contract, which probably are about 20 of them, they provide what we call tuition-based services, and they are classrooms, either integrated classrooms or non-integrated classrooms, where we would bus the children to their classes, and they would be sites such as the Brookside School, Center for Spectrum Services. We have contracts with schools in Dutchess, Orange, Sullivan, as well as Ulster County, because we do have a responsibility to try and get them closest to their home. I hate to have a child on a bus longer. So if I have a child in Walk Hill, I'm going to send them to an Orange County school, possibly, if there's an opening. So that's what these contracts are for.
Thank you. Any questions, comments, or concerns? Legislator Erner?
I have a few, and I'm glad we blocked it because it pertains to all of them. So,
great. Go ahead.
So thank you for that introduction. And are these necessarily all $50,000 plus contracts each year, or is that the life of the contract?
No, we have a total of about 165 contracts. These are all the $50,000 or more. Most of them, because they're agencies, so they provide, we have 750 children identified since last July to now receiving services. That does not include those children that were evaluated and not found eligible. And I couldn't tell you that number because they can come in every 3 months and be reevaluated. And those evaluations are small pieces of it. We have probably another 40 or so individual contracts where there may be like speech therapists or OTs or individuals that contract for that specific service. They work after hours, meaning they probably are most likely with the school district or another program like Brookside School or Center for, and where they pick up those after hours, which I mean 3 to 5 p.m. services for us. That. And then another small amount are smaller agencies that don't rise to the $50,000, maybe because they're new and we haven't built up their caseloads yet for that.
I think legislators are a few more and then we'll go to...
Okay. Thanks. So a number of these I see in Appendix A, approved programs where services are provided, and it always seems to be blank.
I'm sorry.
The Appendix A, approved programs where services are provided, and it always seems to be blank. There seem to be two kinds. One has about 4 columns or 5, the other
is
about 2.
So when the contract actually goes out, it's specific to the services that individual agency provides. So it shouldn't necessarily be blank. I'd have to work with Amy on that, because typically they're like, it'll list speech for... Joanna Newman's a speech service. It would list speech services, or it should be listing that. If it's Brookside School, it probably has a variety of things, so it might be just one encumbering all those services they provide.
Okay, maybe I'll follow up about that.
Was that for all the contracts? Was that for A?
Wherever I saw in Appendix A, it appeared blank.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It wasn't on every contract, though.
I will check with Amy on that, though.
thank you. Great, and the last, you know what, I think that that's, okay, so is this, we're getting these now because it's, the school year's ending and we're planning for the next school year?
The next contract period will start July 1st, 2023, and I'll go through June 30th of 2027, I think, I can't.
27.
The idea that goes that far just bothers my mind, but yeah, it'll go through that period of time, and then we'll start it up again in 4 years, we'll do the same thing. Once we get these approved, we notify all the providers, and then they come in and sign the forms, or we email them the forms and sign it. We try and do different things to make sure that all the contracts are up and running and approved by July 1st, so that when billing starts at the end of July, we can process them.
Excellent. And one more. Can you, real brief summary, there's a lot of contractors. Are there some that are brand new, some that are we've been with for years and years, and some in between?
Most of them for the 50,000 or more have been with us for a long period of time because they have a solid caseload, or they are, again, approved educational programs through the state at Brookside School, Center for Spectrum Services, like that. We have a couple of new agencies or centers, one in Monticello, and we're actually working with the Monticello School District to create one. That'll come after July 1st. They'll probably be at 50,000 because they're tuition-based programs. And on average, our tuitions for districts for individual kids are anywhere from $35,000 to over $40,000 for the school year. Mm-hmm. It all depends on the program because the state sets those tuition rates. So that's why you would have probably 16 or so that are definitely going to be over
50,000
even if
they're
brand new with us.
Thank you very much.
And I'll just share that we did pull up one of the Schedule A for the Appendix A, and it has the headings, but it doesn't have any content.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't mind, if you could look into that and just confirm. There might be a reason why or whatever. I'm not personally too concerned about it, but I think it's actually a very good point to have pointed that out. Especially because those can sometimes be where the most interesting information is on these contracts. So, any other questions, comments? Yeah, questions.
I did just with something you had said about going into schools for speech therapy. Are these are for DSS clients? It's not. So we're paying for. Because when I was a kid, we're going back a long time ago. The school provided that. They would have
a
speech therapist come in, and they'd have you say a couple of things.
Not for preschoolers with special education.
These are all for preschoolers?
Yeah. So it's convoluted. So at the state level, this special education program is 3 to 21. The school districts administer the individual education plans. Mm-hmm. They provide the services for children 5 to 21.
Mm-hmm.
And they're responsible for that. For the children that are 3 to 5, pre-kindergarten age, the county is responsible via state law to provide those services and pay for those services.
And they're not uniquely DSS clients. They can be anybody in the community that has a child that
kids
has been diagnosed and is eligible for these kinds of services. And as Rita said, a really important point is that developmentally, you might have a 3-year-old that is examined by their pediatrician and nothing is disclosed. But in a subsequent examination at 3.5 years old, they may come in. So these are not DSS clients. These are children that are eligible for early intervention in preschool.
Okay.
And then when they turn 5, they enter the school districts, and then the school districts become responsible from 5 to 21.
And that's separate from the Head Start program, which has been getting notices of deficiency.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of
worried
about how their
program. So the Head Start program and us, we partner together. If they have a child that has an individual IEP or individual education plan, we will provide that speech therapist or that teacher to go there.
Mm-hmm.
The Head Starts work really hard with the parents to encourage them to go to the districts to get evaluated, because that's the first step for it. It's a voluntary program. So if you don't have a parent who's willing to follow through with the referral, it's not going to go anywhere. And that's where Head Start's really having difficulty with. They could screen the kids with them to get them to go to the next level. That's what we've been working on.
Yeah, but
And just to clarify, we are reimbursed by the state 59.5%. So we do these contracts, so we're not paying for the whole thing. We're paying 40%.
And we do get Medicaid reimbursement for those that are Medicaid eligible, for those Medicaid services that we can justify. And in Ulster County, we're one of probably six counties in the state that the program does not fall in the health department. Every other county, it's in the health department, but there's like six of us that it falls either in the usually in the social services or their youth and children's services program. So it's a big portion of it, and we partner with them. So we get a lot of referrals from the public health nurses, and we work together.
We offer the child find program, and then we coordinate with Rita. We identify individuals that need that type of service.
Right, and they do health education for us with early intervention and specialized services.
Any other questions, comments?
Good, thank you.
All right, so then we'll call the question on the block of 222 to 264. Are those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, those are unanimous. The next couple are related to those. We've got 265, approving execution of a contract amendment for $70,500 introduced by the county with James McGinnis and Associates, Department of Social Services. So moved. Second, moved by Nolan, second by Petit. This is for the software for the program.
This is our software program. It starts with collecting the data from the school district. We put in the services that are approved. The providers use it to submit all their documentation that is required, such as session notes, their certificates, licenses, everything that we would require for both state ed and for Medicaid purposes. It allows us to, after we pay the providers through the system, we are then able to, through the state program and scheduling, we can go to the state ed and we get our reimbursement portion of the services based on their scheduling. And then for children that are Medicaid eligible, this program will help us go through all those claims and file on our behalf. They will block those claims that don't meet the minimum Medicaid requirements, so we have a good portion of those because maybe it's not signed with timely or it's not the child. Most of the time it's because the child's Medicaid has either ended or there's been an issue with that. They will help us follow up and reimburse or not reimburse, but reclaim if we can. It's not too late. Some of it is our providers are not the best at submitting their documentation on time, so we aren't able to bill them within 90 days, so we get a Medicaid amount for that. But this program does everything from the beginning to our reimbursement for both programs, for both the Medicaid and state ed, to maximize them.
Any questions from the committee? Comments? Concerns? All right, then I'll call the question on 265. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Resolutions that passed unanimously. Resolutions 266 through 269 are all agreements with school districts for contracts and IMAs for the preschool special education program. Is everyone comfortable blocking those?
Make a motion. A second.
Yeah, all right. So that's a motion from Legislator Erner to block 266 to 269, and second by Nolan. Any discussion on the act of blocking them? Yep, Legislator Stewart. Nope.
No, I had a question about the resolution.
So. All right. Any comments, questions, or concerns on the act of blocking them? I will call the question on the act of blocking them. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. 266 and 269 are now blocked. On the blocked resolutions, Legislator Stewart, did you have a question?
I just had a question in that there seems to be a great variance in how much money different school districts are getting. And I was just curious if that's, what accounts for that?
Or you mean like state ed?
Like, for example, I've been overwhelmed by signing things. But, like, for example, I remember going through here that Rhonda School District received considerably less than the Kingston School District. And I was just...
So that's outside of my scope with this.
Right.
These IMAs are regarding same things. They're contracts, basically, that you just approved on the big block. They provide, some of them will provide evaluations and services for us. So they get paid based on the service that they provide. And we have to, because they're a government agency, we do have to do IMA for the contract.
So certain school districts provide more services than other school districts.
Probably more. So with preschool, yeah. So with preschool, it's voluntary on the district if they want to participate and provide those services or not. TRR has been doing it probably for almost 10 years now. They're the first one that stepped into the ring and said, I'm going to become. They actually went through the evaluation and approval process in the state to become an evaluator and a special education center teacher provider. About 3 years ago, 4 years right before COVID, the state changed the regulations and said that if you're a school district, you don't have to go through the evaluation and approval process to be an evaluator. So then that's where we kind of got Roundup Valley on board, Tri Valley, and Kingston. Kingston on Sierra and Tri Valley had expanded their services. They actually do provide services for their UBK kids for that. So we reimburse them on that. One of the drawbacks that I know that other districts have is they don't have staffing to do this, or there's contractual issues from what I heard based on their teacher union contract. The other thing that will scare them, it doesn't usually happen, I tell them that, is that once they become approved as a contractor or an evaluator, they have to accept any referrals from other districts. And a lot of times they like to just stick with the kids in their district. But that doesn't happen often, because if I have a child in Kingston, they're not going to go down the walk trail for an evaluation. Once in a while, it may be, there was a child in Ontario. The mom was a teacher in the Ontario School District. The child was from Marlboro. Ontario did the evaluation for that piece of it. He goes to a daycare in Ontario School District. Ontario actually is providing services for us because it's at one of their UBK programs. So we're trying to work with districts, and hopefully, because we have such a provider shortage and a need for evaluators, we're hoping that over the years they will open up. Monticello School District is, like I mentioned, they are in Sullivan County, but they are approved as not only evaluators, but also as a center-based program. So we will be contracting with them because the children in Elmville and Pine Bush, it'll be a closer distance than coming up here to Kingston or even Brookside School. So we're hoping this is the door that our district may open up for some of that.
Any other questions, comments, or concerns? Yep, Legislator Erner.
And I don't mean to be redundant. It's a little bit like what Legislator Stewart was asking, but I see like Kingston and Ontiora kind of have similar services that are asking for getting similar amount of money. Rondout's got a lot fewer services. Maybe that, along with population, could explain why their contract's a lot less. But then you have Tri-Valley, I guess. I'm not as familiar with that area. They checked a lot of boxes for the kinds of services that they want, but their contracts for very little. Is that because they just don't...
It's voluntary on their part of what they want to be able to provide. Yeah. Tri-Valley, we have probably one or two students over a two-year period that go there, but they will provide every single service. If that child needs, core related services plus CIA, they will provide it. They do have a UPK program, the children we tend to get are in their UPK program, and they put the services there versus having them bus to professional services or Inspire or anything like that. So, again, it's based on whatever that district is interested in doing.
Got it. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
Sorry, just to clarify, it's based on the services and the number of kids combined?
No. The contract is just based on the number of services they're going to provide to
us
for that. He was just saying that he didn't know, wasn't familiar with Tri-Valley, and that's because we have four districts, Tri-Valley, Margaretville, Valley Central, and one other one, Fallsburg, that there are one or two, half a dozen houses that are in Ulster County. And even though they're in a majority in Orange County or Sullivan County, we are responsible for the Ulster County kids in that district.
Okay. Tri-Valley captures Denning.
Okay. Delaware County, too, I think.
All right. Yeah, Delaware County.
Any other comments, questions, or concerns? If not, I'll call the question on the block resolutions 266 to 269. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, those are unanimous. We did the CSB resolutions.
We did not do community action yet, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, Resolution 272, appointing a member to the Ulster County Community Action Committee, Board of Directors.
Move it.
And can I have a second?
Second.
All right, moved by Nolan, second by Erner. And this is the appointment of our esteemed colleague, Legislator Gina Hansen.
Our very own.
Yes. Any questions, comments, or concerns? I didn't think so. I'll call the question on 272. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Well, they will be lucky to have that.
Yes, they will.
Mutually beneficial.
Yeah. All right. 274 we did already. 275 we did already. 276 we did already. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. So now we are into the legislators' resolutions. They say leaders need last, and that's why our resolutions are the last. We will start with Resolution 126, dedicating funding to housing justice. Can I have a motion to discuss?
I'll move it.
All right, moved by Nolan, and I saw his hand from Erner, so second by Erner. And as the author of this, I will just say I hope that everyone saw the county executive's announcement yesterday about the Housing Action Fund. This is incredibly exciting. I've asked for a special meeting of this committee. I texted you all last week, so you probably now realize why I was texting you. We have a meeting on the 18th in the evening to hear an overview of that program, and I hope that you are all able to attend that. And in anticipation of that meeting, I will ask for a postponement of this resolution for 1 month so that we can hear that. So,
make that motion or second it.
Yep, so moved by Erner, second by Nolan. Any discussion on the postponement? All right, on the...
I do. It's getting close to November election, and we... I don't know how to even say this nicely. I mean, what I'm concerned about is it turns into grandstanding, and there's less of, you know, actual, you know, actions to move forward to get things done. I mean, I would love to see your resolution moved forward, and to keep putting it off while we're waiting for... I mean, we already went through an executive who was interested in running for Congress and essentially abandoned us for months, so... I need to know that we're moving forward, and as we close down these, you know, flea bag motels that we're paying thousands of dollars a month for, that people are going to have a place to go. So
I appreciate you saying that. Do you want to speak to that, Deputy Executive? I don't know that you necessarily need to, but...
No, I mean, I could just say that we're definitely working on it. There's a lot of work in terms of, I think from you all we heard that there needed to be more information in terms of what the fund is actually for and what projects are going to be eligible. So that's what is being fleshed out now, and I think it's important to work through all that in creating the resolution. So it's because of work being done. So I just wanted to assure you of that.
Yeah, and I'll just share, you know, And I think the county executive's team would probably attest that I personally have been pretty impatient about all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I see Joanna nodding her head. So I completely hear you on that, and I wouldn't be asking for this postponement if I didn't think it was our best shot at getting something sooner than later.
Okay. I just wanted to ask if there's some flexibility on the time. I'm probably going to have to join that meeting remotely, but it would also help me if it were earlier in the day. Is that a possibility for others on the committee? Are we planning it at 5?
Yeah, why don't we, I don't know, I can tell you I won't make that decision right now.
Okay.
But why
take it
don't you,
under advisement?
If you can email me, well, okay. Just can you email me, like, what your constraint is,
yep.
Like, what would be the ideal time, and then we'll do the process of asking it. It would be overwhelming for me mentally to try and figure that out right now.
I will just say, so that everybody knows that I'm a panelist on a webinar on ticks that evening. And so I am doing I'm doing the work of the committee. So that's at 6 p.m. So I'll send you that information and we can see.
Okay.
And maybe maybe I drop out and come back in or whatever.
I don't think it's going to be a particularly long meeting.
Okay.
I don't think we're not going to take
this
any.
Will be
this
will be the only subject.
This will be the only subject, correct.
Great.
Yeah.
So it's not a round table for discussion? Is it a presentation?
It's going to be a presentation, and then we'll have questions.
Okay.
Yeah. And we can have discussion. The model in my mind is, remember when we had that special Ways and Means meeting about the Government Operations Center? It's like that, only with a much brighter topic to discuss.
Okay.
But that'll be the format. We'll be sitting in there, we'll get a presentation, we'll ask questions, and we'll have, you know, discussion if we want to have discussion. But there's not going to be like resolutions that are considered that evening.
So did you want a motion to postpone?
We have a motion on the table to postpone, and we voted to, let's see. Now, I will now call the question. We're discussing the motion to postpone right now. That's where we're at, correct? Yeah. So if everyone's comfortable with postponing it, if a couple of you want to vote no, you certainly can. So I'll call the question. All those in favor of postponing 126?
Aye.
Any opposed? Yep, legislator proceed to post. I appreciate it. I consider that a vote for urgency, and
yeah,
I completely agree.
And I appreciate what you've done. I mean, we have the REPCO, but that, you know, again, that was November, and it's May, and hopefully that'll start soon. But I mean, it's urgent.
In August last year. So
yeah,
that was the former administration, for what it's worth. All right. 127, establishing a policy to prioritize meals for Ulster County residents living in emergency housing.
Can I just ask a question about the proposed the meeting that's coming up?
Yes.
I've had several constituents ask to be sitting on that meeting. Is that a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. It's a public meeting, and that's why we're going to have it in there, and I would encourage everyone to invite anyone. I mean, any member of the public can come here. I will just say, while we're on this topic, if anyone ever thinks that a lot of people in the public are going to come to this meeting, please give me or Jay a heads up. You can see we were running out of seats before.
Right.
We can change to a larger venue. Just if anyone is ever, like, you know, expecting, I don't know, like a marching band to show up. Just to pick a random thing. Just please give me a heads up.
And it will also be available on Zoom, correct?
Yeah, I think we'll be able to facilitate Zoom. We're not going to do... I'm going to need to touch base with Vicky about that. But that's my hope, is that it will be available on Zoom. And I'm trying
to provide that for the public.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
By my needing it for... I'm going to be out of town that day.
Yeah, and will members of the public be able to ask questions, or it's just simply...
There's not going to be any public comment or,
no
or
public
questions. Yeah, yeah.
Right. They can submit questions.
But they could.
They can submit questions. Absolutely. And if any legislator, you know, as a representative of the public, would like to ask those questions, you're
and
sure.
And that's something they do in advance, or that's something they do afterwards, or.
Well, if you want, I mean, I would say if people have questions, the sooner the better, because you could be the one who asks their question, and if you don't have it ahead of time, then you won't know to do that.
That is an excellent point.
Yeah.
So, is there a preview out yet? Of whatever the proposal is, a direct no? It'd be hard to formulate questions ahead.
I don't believe that we've
okay.
gotten the draft yet. I'm hoping that...
Give out your text number.
Yeah.
I will check, but I don't know where that is. I'm sure it's in the works, but I don't
So, with that, we'll go into Resolution 127, establishing a policy to prioritize meals for Ulster County residents living in emergency housing. Can I have a motion to discuss?
I'll move it.
All right, moved by Nolan, second by Erner. And then this is another one of mine, so I'm just going to say the emergency housing situation, I don't know if y'all are in the news at all this week, but it's very complicated. And I've had some conversations with the county executive team since initially introducing this. There are some legitimate questions about the logistics of administering this program, and that all got a lot more complicated by one of our largest hotel venues being deemed unsuitable yesterday. And so this, too, I will ask for a postponement on.
I make a motion that we postpone for a month.
There's a motion from Nolan. Can I have a second, and then we'll discuss it? Yep, second by Corcoran. Let's have the discussion here. So, discussion on the postponement, Legislator Petit.
I'm just, no.
Yeah. I hear that.
Yeah, I mean, you've had it well thought out. This is your second or third postponement? This
will be the first.
Yeah.
I mean, it was,
okay.
we advanced it last month.
I mean, we did Project Resilience, so we've been out there and we know how to do this. I'm not quite sure why we need to hold it up. And it's for an RFP, right?
Yeah.
Which adds another 6 months
I'll say this.
People can't eat for 6 months.
The main justification that I see for postponing it is it was announced yesterday, it was kind of buried at the bottom of the press release, that the county is going to be doing an independent review of the emergency housing situation.
Right.
And so this is something a few of us have been asking for a while, so I'm very appreciative to the county executive's team for moving forward with that. And I think some of the questions that came up in committee last month are potentially going to be answered there. I think to Legislator Nolan's point, those were some of the questions that you were bringing up.
Yeah.
So I'm very concerned about this, and I will say that even though I'm disappointed in postponing it, I'm glad that the conversation that we had about this elevated the profile of this conversation, and I wonder, and I don't mean to imply that this was additional pressure, but I think we perhaps have created an environment where there's much more unanimity in seeing the urgency of emergency housing. So I'm still encouraged by the progress that we're making by trying to attack some of these issues, but I think it's probably not prudent to try and set this in motion right now, which pains me to say so, Deputy.
I think that's fair to say, and just to put a finer point on it, one of the pieces that we're asking the evaluators to look at in the study is optimizing access to basic services, including transportation and food security. We're just asking to have a holistic look at the whole system instead of starting a new initiative that is a pretty large-scale initiative without having that review first. And just to remind you all, I had sent Legislator Uchitel an update earlier today, but the ARPA food security project that we funded is in the works, and it's 50 or so groups who do emergency feeding that are meeting and talking about what is needed to support their efforts. Kingston Emergency Food Collaborative is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they had their first meeting, their second meeting's coming up, and they've already had conversations around how we could help. So I think it's best to go through that process and see what the recommendation is as to how the county can help, as opposed to starting something in addition to what they're already doing. So that's just my recommendation.
Yep. I strongly agree with that and had raised some of these points last month. I think that even Michael Berg's presentation today about what's provided at Darmstadt Shelter, I was aware that they did something, but not nearly in that detail. So I see what we're doing, in holding off on creating a policy, is to get a lay of the land and some basic data on all these programs and what's currently being done. It may be that we want to then create a policy that says we should be doing exactly what's being done, but we may also decide we want to create a policy that affirms what we're doing and adds something or goes in some different directions. But I feel much better getting that real grounding in what we're currently doing before it just keeps the policy really connected to the realities on the ground. So especially in the setting where we have the system kind of in flux with some churning around because of a crisis. And I think we'll have a better policy and a feeling of more collaboration
if we do, step back and make it a little more spacious right now, and then come in with what the legislature sees as the picture and the problems and the solutions.
Legislator Stewart?
I had a question I wanted to address to the county executive, if that's possible.
Please.
I'd requested, we had that great conversation a week or so ago, and I'd requested the tour of the emerging housing motel, and I was wondering if that is something that we could do sooner rather than later, or if that should wait until after this study is conducted. I wasn't sure what your thinking on that topic was and what the thinking of the committee is.
Yes, thank you. I did follow up on that. I think that what I would propose is that we do, so the county executive is going to do tours soon of some additional motels. I would propose that perhaps the chair and the vice chair of this committee attend with a tour. My only concern is like a bunch of people coming with a critical eye to all these motels at one time, because we're also going to have, we want to have our health department staff who there to show us, to show the county executive their process for doing the inspections. We want to have DSS there as well. So just trying to avoid this like big retinue of like, you know,
government officials
showing up all at once. So this is what I think that you all should be part of it, but maybe one or two of the committee.
Could I propose that either the chair or the chair's delegate be invited, and the delegate could be potentially from the district in which some of these sites, the hotels are?
I think that's a great idea. And I'll just say, like, there are some of us who have spent time already there.
Yes,
I have been up there many times. I know Legislator Erner has, so I don't need to go. I know what's going on. So we'll figure that out. I think that's a great thing. And I also will point out that, you know, that we have to be, you know, when we all assemble in a location where topics pertinent to the committee will be discussed, we are a quorum, and that has to be a publicly noticed event that the public can attend.
Right.
So we have to avoid that. And one way to avoid that is to divvy up who's going to go where.
Yeah.
Commissioner Smith.
Yeah, I just want to make sure we put this in a context, though, just for point of reference. The Department of Health permits all temporary residences in the county, and that's any facility that basically houses 11 or more on an interim basis. We have 98 permitted temporary residences in Ulster County overall. That includes hotels, motels, cabin colonies, and so forth. Of that 98 total permitted group of facilities, it's everything from the Residents in and what have you to down the road here, the best quality in, et cetera. Used to be the quality in, but nevertheless, it's all of them. Of that 98, 25 are currently housing clients under an emergency housing need. And it runs the gamut from the chain hotels that are nationwide chains to very localized facilities. So what we're talking about is quite a span of different types of facilities and different levels of, I guess, of public-facing reputation, so to speak. So I think that when this is conducted, it more or less needs to be, I think, on a strategic basis, because we certainly want to respect the motels that are accommodating our folks that need emergency housing, with 300 to 400, I guess, Mike, that we have that are in need of that type of housing, and they are accommodating these individuals. I don't want them to feel that they're being targeted or to present any more barriers to preserving that kind of ability to put people there. Versus some that obviously are needing some repairs of various sorts, but as per the current one. But, you know, we do have quite a spectrum of facilities that do provide this service in the county.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, thank you, Dr. Smith. What I would propose is that we go to a few, the ones that start with a few that we, the ones that we hear about a lot, and kind of go. Actually, just I got a date today that could work for the county executive, so I will send that to you all or to you, and you know, figure out what you're doing. Okay.
Laura is going to be unavailable.
Okay.
And she's a key person.
Yes. Okay. So we'll get a new date. We'll get a new date, and then we'll circulate it. But I do think we wouldn't have time to go to all 25,
right.
So we should triage.
Yeah, and please just direct that correspondence
with Jay.
To Jay.
Yeah, yep.
Thank you. Legislator, proceed.
Thank you. And going back to the resolution, I always appreciate Legislator Nolan's insight. And yes, we probably need to pull in, we should, all of the, I mean, even Michael Berg's program, we were involved. It's a it's a food insecurity collaborative, and it was the hubs where all of the farm food comes into.
That's
which
the
gets
one that
distributed
I'm talking about. That's the one
is
we
that
funded.
The one you're talking
yes.
about?
Yes.
Okay.
They're managing it.
But there's also an immediate need, so I don't know how to not hold off. I mean, when I get a call from Legislator Erner that, you know, there's a family that had to sleep outside and they hadn't eaten in 3 days, that's where I'd like to see an additional push, even if it's a short-term project resilience, just something, because people can't eat retroactively. I mean, we need to, you know, take care of them and their families during any interim process of housing. Or
that's a great quote, by the way.
But
people
so
can't eat retroactively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we heard previously from Commissioner Director that the county already has a priority to make sure that people are fed. When we're providing shelter, it's not considered sufficient just to provide a roof, that it has to be livable circumstances. So I think what you're talking about is implementation of that policy. This, you know, creating another policy is to, you know, create the framework for expanding that, looking at it further. But I think to ask for the county executive's office and the departments to make it a priority is also okay and doesn't require, you know, the passing of a generalized policy, because it's already within the purview. And you know, when I hear that somebody has received a report about a family in that circumstance, the question I have is, okay, how do we bring them into the system?
Right.
Where did they not make a connection? Because that's not what we want happening, and our programs are set up to prevent that, as I understand it, or to address it.
I'll just point out that if this advanced, it would do nothing for that family, because if they're not, this would feed folks that have been placed
already in a
yeah,
household.
So someone has refused placement, or you know, weren't able to, didn't, you know, whatever the circumstances were, this wouldn't capture them. So I just wanted to point that out.
And do you want to expand further, or did I misrepresent the situation?
No, I agree with you that there's already programming in place to address the kind of circumstances that you were identifying, and then I think access to that programming that might be experienced by an individual is something that does have to be closely examined when it's reported to us. And frequently, you know, we can determine what engagement has taken place. Now, I think a dynamic that also has to be acknowledged sometimes is, you know, navigating around individual preferences and choices that can sometimes create some challenges in terms of arriving at engagement. So I think that's, you know, a very valid point. You know, and obviously with regard to the remarks that have been made with regard to emergency housing at the various locations. You know, I think that recent events suggest that we might be moving in a direction that might result in requiring standards that exceed currently permitted thresholds. We don't place clients in facilities that are not fully permitted, and that has always been the case. And I hear frequent references to the fact that Fleabag motels, dumps,
mostly bed bug motels, but yeah.
That too.
Yeah.
But I do think that one of the encouraging developments is maybe as a result of some recent events, there's more recognition that this is a collective responsibility of the entire community and many
mm-hmm.
entities.
Mm-hmm.
Because as long as these are permitted facilities with their certificates of occupancies and their operating permits, I think there has to be some acknowledgement that as long as that's the case, if we're moving in a direction where permitted facilities that are permitted, you know, by entities and municipalities no longer meet the standards that this county is going to require, where we're going to turn in terms of finding infrastructure and capacity is going to be potentially challenging. And I think that in terms of scheduling the hotel and motel tours that take place, if there happens to be an arrival at a decision that a permanent facility is no longer suitable, as the chair referred to, then where are we going to turn? And then how are we going to arrive at creating a new set of standards that we implement and enforce at new locations in an environment where there's basically no other existing infrastructure? So I just offer that as an
yeah.
observation and a cautionary remark about some of the momentum that's building up around this when you're day in and day out trying to find placements for between 300 and 350 individuals. And it was also referenced that it's a broken system. I'm not entirely sure that you can just simply make a characterization of that nature, because we often deal with the individual preferences of clients facing homelessness who don't want to necessarily be receptive to accepting placement at an available location or where we have inventory. I think Legislature Erner, in connection with his questions that he raised with Executive Director Berg, you know, was referencing some of that, that there are individuals who don't necessarily want to go into a shelter or don't want to go into an available motel. And when that happens, I think we also have to have realistic expectations of what are our options then? And this is a system that's stressed. It's also a system that was never designed to permanently house people
mm-hmm.
for several years. One of the reasons why I think we're reaching this stressor point is that we see people that have been in emergency placements for several years. Pre-COVID, it was a system that accommodated people for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 30 to 45 days. That was when we did have available permanent affordable housing that they could transition into. That's not the case. And I think a hard reality is that we are at a place where the lack of affordable permanent housing is creating these periods of duration in emergency housing that are no longer tolerable. And that's where the system is feeling stress. And I think that what I'm often contending with and being confronted with is very simplistic generalizations that are critical of a system that is doing everything it can to accommodate what is a very urgent need every day. I've said it at this meeting before. I've been at the Department of Social Services for over 30 years, and staff there have been committed to housing people for those three decades, day in and day out, every single day. No day is more urgent than another, and yesterday wasn't any more urgent than tomorrow is going to be. And this is our lived reality, trying to support clients in these circumstances. And I guess I just would appreciate understanding and patience and consideration and thoughtfulness around some of the remarks that get made and then are perpetuated, because there's so much more involved in doing this work. And I think Executive Director Berg brought that up, and you know, I feel like I have an affirmative obligation to also bring it up. You know, we have a system that we have to work within. There's no way I can conjure up inventory and infrastructure that can meet the needs that we have. And I think when we make some of the statements that we do, we have to be cautious about potentially how are we going to follow through on this. Because if this county elects to change this emergency housing system, it better be prepared to figure out a thoughtful way to do it. the shelter model and the motel model have been the models that have been in place since the 1960s. I've done research on this, and they're not ideal. I've talked with Legislature Erner about this. It's too bad that every municipality doesn't have its own dedicated shelter. It's too bad we didn't evolve as a culture and a society that way, but we haven't. So that doesn't exist. And to create it, it's not impossible, but it would take an enormous amount of effort. When we can't even sustain recertifying existing boarding homes to continue to provide capacity, and we have so much trouble getting affordable housing projects to be undertaken, and although we have a lot in the pipeline, it's just clearly not enough, and it's taking way too long to happen. So I just think, you know, there needs to be some really thoughtful consideration about some of the reactionary conversation that takes place. So that's
so we'll go
probably more than you expected.
No,
but
no,
okay, no,
no,
I appreciate
I'm
it.
We'll go to
Legislator Nolan, then Deputy Executive Contreras, then Commissioner Smith.
Just call me Nolan.
Oh, sorry, not Nolan. I'm so sorry.
But, and yes, there's many entities involved, and some of them are very aware of the conditions of these places. But they also understand that if they get closed, what's going to happen. What I'm hoping is that one has been, and that now this slumlord is going to be financially impacted, that perhaps that'll put a light bulb off for all of these other, hotels and motels that we're using, because I've been in them when we were delivering food, and it's, I also want to say, because I had gotten an email from you once before when I was frustrated about the system. You are not the system, and I would like to apologize every time we get frustrated. It's not a personal attack on you. And we've had discussions about, you know, ticking off that box number 4 so that, you know, that then our boarding house people can't get food stamps. And I understand that's all part of a really antiquated New York State and federal system. What I'm hoping is that Ulster County can now be in the forefront of fixing that and arguing for new legislation and laws to pull us out of the 1960s. And I certainly don't want to go back to the 1980 or the 1890 poorhouses. But, it's not, you've always been very responsive whenever I've sent questions out. I realize that there's always two sides to each story, so I appreciate your candor. And yes, when we're going after the system, it's not after you or staff, at least not for me.
No,
I appreciate what you do.
But
yeah.
I also think it's important that we have these dialogues, because we're still the individuals that are responsible for trying to operate within this structure, so we can recognize flaws in the system, and
mm-hmm.
we can recognize when we reach points, and the inability of this current system to sustain people in emergency housing for this duration
yeah.
of time
yeah.
is certainly revealing a major flaw and weakness, and I think, you know, that's part of what's being responded to, so thank you for that, Legislator Petit.
And how many people were in Roadway Inn? I mean, how many people did we get displaced? Were there 20?
50.
50.
We had,
the 30 rooms.
Wow.
We had about 28 rooms with a total of 18 individuals and 10 families. That comprised about 29 people. But to the degree that the Roadway generally is providing between 7 and 8% of our emergency housing needs. So, you know, that's just a reflection of the fact that it is spread out around the county.
Mm-hmm.
Deputy Executive Contreras, and then Commissioner Smith.
I just wanted to underscore and thank the Commissioner for his comments and reiterate that, yes, we do want to go on tours with you, but caution against haste, because while Commissioner, I oppose you saying no day is more stressful than the next. I think that it's fair to say the last few days have been extremely stressful
mm-hmm.
because it was already extremely hard to find placements for the 350 or so people that need emergency housing, and now we just lost another 30 units.
Yeah.
So that's a reality. It is going to add more stress. I know Michael Berg is extremely stressed about this. So
it's important to look at these motels, and you know, I'm happy that we're all doing this together. But it does. I think it's really important to not be reactive and to realize that if we stop something, there has to be another option. Is it necessarily better to put people in a congregate facility? Is it necessarily better to put people out of county? Those aren't easy questions to answer. So I just wanted to echo that.
Thank you. Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, I mean, Commissioner Iapochi said it also eloquently, and I agree totally. And coming from the perspective of the department that's charged with inspections and permitting, and in working with the owner-operators of all these facilities, and knowing that, you know, the motel system was not made to support emergency housing for prolonged periods of time, to provide for the kitchen facilities and the sanitary facilities, et cetera. And, you know, the stressors put on some of these motels and hotels and the privacy of the individuals placed there, I think that we need to have a level of sensitivity for these owners, operators who are providing this sort of accommodation in our county. And I know we're speaking to the needs of the most needful residents, but remember, you know, the tourism and whatever is a big economic driver for this county. And if we penalize some of these motel operators for what's going on with their inability to really support the emergency housing population, I think we're looking at it in a punitive way for that particular, like I said, there are 98 of them out there, 25 of whom are agreeing to provide this level of support to these individuals. So I think we do have to be really careful about how we portray it, how we look at it, and how we manage some surveillance and some supervision over it.
Thank you.
Yep. I would just add that I know that somebody clients who have been served by DSS, many of them would greatly prefer to be in a motel that might be substandard in this county than to go out of county. And some others are the opposite way. So it may be that, you know, there's a way for us to try to get a finer grasp of how we serve everyone if the facility is permitted. But it's considered substandard by some, then maybe that's an individual evaluation that we can support in some way. So that's my comment. My question is, of the 73 permitted facilities who are not currently accepting clients, are there things that we could look to be doing to try to expand and bring in? And is that part of what this idea that the public conversation might encourage people to step forward if we conduct it in a way that talks about this as a community service?
So, I mean, in anticipation of some of this, I have done outreach in connection with collaboration through the county executive's office as recently as earlier this year to try to identify some locations and appeal to them with respect to the challenges we're facing and do so to start a dialogue. Unfortunately, there was not any response to some of the additional locations I reached out to. And, you know, we also had to be mindful. A lot of the facilities that Dr. Smith is referencing are small. They will have more than 11 units, but they're smaller operations that are not necessarily conducive location-wise to, and they're generally never having any vacancies available. So that's been an issue, but, you know, to the degree that might be something we can revisit, Legislator Nolan, you know, I think it could be an idea, you know, and you said it articulately as well. You know, we can use words like substandard to characterize or, you know, lower level, but in terms of facilities being permitted and them being available for us to at least contact and explore, and you know, I appreciate so much what you said about some of the Samadhi referrals that we work with, that I've worked very close with David McNamara on. Some persons want to be in a specific location because they're either coming in or are coming out of treatment or going into treatment, and they want to be isolated from potential other dynamics that could risk
mm-hmm.
their ongoing ability to remain stable. And we take all of those factors into consideration. So that's something that, you know, is really important to also talk about. I appreciate that you said that.
Deputy Executive.
And just to add to that, there was that outreach done, but that's not where it stopped. I know you said that you can't conjure additional inventory, but you definitely try.
I'm also trying to do a couple other things.
There are some other new things that we're trying too that have resulted in us being able to place DSS clients in hotels that we haven't traditionally placed at, and we're also not. You know, we're pushing back on the notion that a hotel can just say that they're not going to place DSS clients. So definitely it's not, I don't want to leave the impression that we're just sticking with the 20 that we've worked with historically
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, stopping there. We're definitely trying everything we can.
Great, thank you. Legislator.
I'm going to try and be brief. I'm feeling quite angry right now. You know, nobody who needs these services that we're talking about is in this room and participating in this discussion right now. So I'm just putting that out there, first of all. I'm hearing a lot of generalizations about considerations we should give to motels. What about the fact that the motels countywide and beyond are telling our people you get 21 days to be there? I'm hearing proposals, well, what we need to do is ask the state to just change the law so that they wouldn't become residents after 30 days, and then we'd have more space and they'd be able to stay longer. Well, how about we use the state power to guarantee something like a basic necessity which people need to live, like housing, instead of curtailing the rights of the people that they fought so hard for over centuries? I couldn't disagree more with that flipping of the way forward here. And in terms of, you know, we've had motels or hotels that have punished the entire population of the county based on an accusation against a certain guest's behavior. They're just like, oh, this guest did that thing. We're not going to house anybody else anymore because they did that, which never had to be litigated in a court. They just had to make the accusation. That's taken as what happened. And then, well, when are we going to stand up and fight back? When are we going to stand truly with the people who are calling me every day and every week, often the same people? Like, what do I have to do to get these people what they need? That's really all I have to say.
I can respond to some of that, Legislature Erner. With regard to your point about hotel owners and managers making accusations against individual guests, we do look at each and every one of those scenarios. And there are occasions where, unfortunately, there may have been an incident where a guest has been disruptive at a hotel or damaged a room. And that is a justification for a hotel to make a decision to not continue that person's reservation. And as much as you may not accept or disagree with that, that is something that we try to work with. That doesn't mean that we don't continue to make placements at that motel. That just means that that individual client who's been identified as causing damage or being disruptive is a justification. If there is a motel that we're working with that is refusing to take reservations, we make them aware of the fact that that's discriminatory conduct and that is not an acceptable practice. And that if they do not accept our reservation, we will make a referral to the Human Rights Commission and the Attorney General's office, which we have been doing. So with respect to that particular dynamic, we don't accept having motels or hotels behave in a way that because one of our clients may have caused damage, that they cannot accept reservations from us for other clients. So I just want you to be aware of that. That's what we have been doing. We have involved our Human Rights Commission, and we have had meetings around the protocols involved in doing that. With regard to the existing statutory 30-day, that is something that has to be arrived at pursuant to taking action that you're suggesting, legislation that could be changed around that. I don't don't think it's capitulating to anything. I think it's identifying the fact that the motels are not necessarily designed to become permanent residents for people. I agree strongly with your viewpoint that housing is a right. And obviously we're undertaking a lot of other initiatives to try to create that housing. I mean, the motel model for emergency housing is experiencing an enormous amount of stress. It wasn't designed to be emergency housing. So in terms of that, yes, clearly, you know, if a motel owner is trying to run a commercial operation where they're accepting reservations from the general public and at the same time they're accepting reservations from us, there's definitely going to be some need to balance, you know, that challenge in terms of the guests that they have at their establishment. And the persons who have made a reservation at a motel that are visiting Ulster County have an expectation that at the motel they're going to receive certain services that they expected were going to be available in connection with their reservation. It's absolutely a true circumstance where the stress and the pressure that our emergency homeless clients are experiencing, many of whom have been in emergency housing placements for long periods of duration, you know, that is starting to also be one of the consequences. So I, you know, want to obviously acknowledge the concerns that you have and the anger that you're experiencing and saying that these are where the stresses are in the system. I don't think that we can particularly expect motel owners to say that we are going to discontinue in the business that we expected to be in and become a permanent housing facility for people that can't find housing elsewhere. I mean, this is a real stress, and I think it manifests itself when we have these ongoing placements that have become for such a long duration. I mean, if there were affordable housing inventory that people could be transitioning to, and it's in the pipeline, but it's not here right now. So, you know, and each and every time that anything is brought to our attention, we devote ourselves to looking at what the circumstances are and addressing the issues.
So we have deviated a bit from the resolution. Mm-hmm. I knew this topic was going to come up at some point tonight. I didn't know which resolution it would be. I'm glad that we're having this conversation, and I appreciate the comments here, but I do want us to get back onto this resolution. There's currently a motion on the table to postpone Resolution 127. Is there any further discussion on the postponement of 127? All right, then I'll call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Yes. Opposed.
Okay, we've got Petit and Werner are opposed.
I'm going to vote no in solidarity with
the motion to postpone fails, 3-3.
Okay.
Did you intend with your vote to make the motion fail?
I did not intend to make the motion fail.
No, she's going to push.
Did you reconsider?
I'm going to reconsider that vote in light of the sponsor.
Do you want me to vote no on this?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, that's okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
I will change
we'll
my vote.
Make our statements, yeah. You're welcome to make a statement.
All right. I will also mention with this resolution and the last one, the fact is these resolutions get the warmest reception on this committee, and I hate seeing my resolutions fail in Ways and Means. So that's part of why I asked for the postponement. So I appreciate that. What would likely happen is it would go to Ways and Means, and then it would get postponed back here. Also because I hate seeing my resolutions fail in Ways and Means, I'd rather see them postpone it. So or not postpone it, but send it back to us, because I really want us to be in the substantive stuff. So I do, like, in the back of my mind, not just as the author or the sponsor, but also as the chair of this committee, I really try not to send resolutions to Ways and Means that I feel are going to end up getting substantive scrutiny around the substance as opposed to fiscal scrutiny. I want them to go to Ways and Means and just get fiscal scrutiny. I don't want them to get subject matter scrutiny. And that's part of my reason for recommending the postponement here.
My apologies for throwing a wrench in the system.
No. It is absolutely, like, if it's the will of the committee and you want to vote no, that's totally fine. It'll go to Ways and Means. I know it won't have the support in Ways and Means, and it'll come back here next month, which is where it was going to be anyway. So really the only thing we're doing by postponing it is just
sit and wait for the task of, or the, you know, the opportunity to support it. So I'm fine with whatever the committee wants to do.
And the timeline would definitely be next month then? Or are we going to have to postpone it again? And that goes for your the other resolution that we just postponed.
Yeah, no, that one I think...
Legislator Erner mentioned maybe we could vote on it on the 18th.
I don't think that that's probably going to be likely.
Okay.
I'm waiting on language from the county executive's team on how that resolution will be updated to include the housing action fund that was announced yesterday.
Okay.
So, all right, so then as it stands currently, the resolution is postponed by a vote of 4-2.
Correct.
Okay. Our last resolution tonight, resolution...
Can I just say that I'd really appreciate the committee thinking about the implications of the votes in the way of sending messages as well as trying to do the work and keep the work here if we can.
Right. Well, in some ways, to be totally transparent, this resolution was an opportunity to send a message in the first place.
Correct.
Resolution 134, supporting freedom of choice in relation to COVID-19 shots. Can I have a motion to discuss? By Pachit, can I have a second? Second by Erner. And I will defer to the sponsor, who I think has some amendments.
I created two additions. They're whereases that I could read. And I had an eye toward removing contentious language and components because I want to make sure we can have a healthy conversation about this. And my two additions were about the resolution that this legislature passed on June 21st that corporations are not people and should not be able to influence our government using money. The next resolution talks about the $55 billion that the pharmaceutical companies made in the last 3 years. And then the other addition is about the April 19th guidance that no longer recommends the original monovalent mRNA vaccine in the United States. I did that because I felt it's great timing, only 1 week after this new guidance, that most people don't even realize that the original vaccines, I don't actually call them vaccines, but those original shots that were being promoted by this body and other bodies are no longer recommended. That means sometimes we're wrong. And I wrote a piece about 2 years ago called We're Being Lied To, or How I Learned to Love the Vaccine. And there's a paragraph in there about how in the late 1800s, the New York State Legislature was so committed to bloodletting that they embarrassed the head doctors in the state that were against bloodletting. The main doctor was Dr. Benjamin Rush, and he almost killed Abigail Adams with bloodletting. And so in the late 1800s, the New York State Legislature was convinced bloodletting was the solution. And so sometimes we're wrong, including how now the monovalent mRNA vaccine is no longer recommended in the United States. And I think this is a discussion of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if I may read the definition of liberty. The state of being free within society from oppressive restrictions imposed by authority on one's way of life, behavior, or political views. We removed the religious exemption to vaccines when there was supposedly a measles outbreak. And when I asked Executive Ryan at the time how many people had measles, he said two. And that led to the removal of our religious freedoms. So I get concerned when giant corporations start becoming powerful, because I think the separation of...
Corporations and state.
I'm confused because now it's corporation and state, but at the time it was... religion and state, mm-hmm. church and state. And that's because they were so powerful that they were influencing government. And now I believe it should be the separation of corporation and state. And that's it. Sometimes we're wrong, and I want to make sure our constituents have a choice. Especially now, I'm not talking about all vaccines because I'm an advocate of vaccines and the technology. But this one that is still so experimental that the guidance just last week.
Yeah. I agree with much of what you say, but I don't find a lot of that in this resolution. The resolution does seem to be have a take some that does tend to present immunization in general in a bad light and talks a lot about corporations rather than about any particular limitation on individual freedom. So what I don't see is, in New York State in particular, where there is a constraint of individual liberty that we could look at together and decide is proper or improper. So this is directed at such a level that it tends to obscure for me what is really important and what I'd like to know about, which is, are there individuals who are being have their liberties restricted in a way that on reflection by a group like this we would find to be improper and that we would want to legislate about. I could be in on that. I've given lectures about the importance of parental autonomy in regard to immunization of children. And I really feel that it's important. There are public health situations where I could be convinced as a clinician that we should restrict individual freedoms. Two cases of measles can be in a particular circumstance can become 200 cases very quickly, and children can die from that. So when a decision by an adult or a group of adults puts children at risk, I do see a role for social action. And that's why we have Children's Protective Services, is children aren't considered property. So it's a complex line, but because it's so complex, I'm really uncomfortable with dealing with it at this kind of level, which to me tends to get us away from that kind of critical thinking and protection of an individual. So I, again, would ask you to come with a case or cases or instances that you think are improper of the state infringing on individual liberties in New York, in Ulster County, and then let's devise a policy that addresses that, both locally and if we need to take it to the state to go with it.
Thank you.
Legislator Nolan? Oh my God. I'm so sorry.
Could you come sit down?
No, clearly I have one particular wire cross.
And if I could, to the chair too, Legislator Nolan, would the comfort level be different? Here's, you know, where I'm not disagreeing with Legislator Hewitt about a shot, because I don't feel it raises immunity, but it doesn't make you immune. And I think that was what happened with the second horrible round of COVID, was that, oh, we're all going in for our immunization, and then everybody went out and no masks on, and, you know, parties with 50 people, and we had all these super spreaders. So my feeling is, if it's now the COVID shot, then when will it be the flu shot and the you know, whatever else they have, pneumonia, all these other ones will then become mandated. And I was always, my kids got their immunization, but it was limited. You know, I didn't feel comfortable with every new thing that came up, but I know obviously polio and all these childhood diseases where people my grandparents' age, you know, when polio went through a house of eight, it was terrifying. So where can we draw that line then? And how could we sort of meet and compromise at the difference between a real immunization where you would need it updated every 10 years to just the shot of the month where it's constantly changing? You don't know what, there's a new variant out too, which I'm sure everybody's aware of, which is Omicron and something else, and it's now, I mean.
Abercrombie.
I would just say again that I think that those are valid conversations, but I don't see in New York State and Ulster County the specifics. And this goes now back to my time in law school. If you try to legislate for hypotheticals, you're going to do less good than if you wait till you actually know what you're dealing with, and then you legislate on concrete situations. And your errors can be in every direction. You can go too far, you cannot go far enough, because you don't know what you're talking about. So I don't see that we have the situation, and maybe I'm just not aware of it, the situation where we would have an individual restricted at this time from school, work. In fact, the restrictions are being removed that had been in place.
Mm-hmm.
So the timing of it may be just, you know, it may be the right kind of idea, but the timing has passed when there were restrictions being placed. Restrictions have been removed for a year, 6 months. And I don't see those coming back into place on this particular vaccination. So maybe we just keep this and we have it ready if, you know, things ramp up on a new something that comes. Or we really look to see if there are incidences that I'm not well enough aware of that need to be addressed.
So they're not mandating it?
Tell me what the mandates are that you're objecting to. That's what I don't see in here.
I brought it at this time because of the concerns I've heard from constituents, and my goal, I'm not sure about the timing of when to do this, but certain people want to talk about their employment being jeopardized and a variety of ways freedom has been impinged, and that's why this resolve is in here that appeals to private businesses, institutions, and education and religious providers to be considerate and accommodating. Because, for example, one person will be coming to speak who was forced to get the vaccine or it's considered quitting, not being fired, so he couldn't get any benefits after being there for 32 years. Two teachers who were commuting here from the Bronx were both fired from their jobs and became homeless because they refused to get the vaccine. These are things that these employers put on people because they had a question. And so I think I can create examples. I'm just not sure when.
That particular paragraph that Legislator Hewitt just referred to is perhaps the most concerning to me in this resolution, because I'm aware of folks who can't go places precisely because we have relaxed the regulations, and there are some establishments that require you to come in wearing a mask, and I've seen fights break out over people who didn't want to put a mask on. It's like, you're in a private business and they're asking you to respect the rules, and why won't you do that? That's almost the 180-degree polar opposite of what this resolve says. So maybe there's room for people respecting vaccine choice, but there's also room for people respecting other practices in the public health's interest. That there's where I'm not seeing that aspect of reflected on balance in here. But I'd also love to know, since Commissioner Smith, you've hung out with us this whole time, in your medical opinion, what can you tell us that might inform us on this resolution before us, if you've looked at it?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm not sure that this is really the place to have a resolution like that that's so broad-based, but, you know, I think we also in government have an obligation to protect our constituency. Individual freedoms are one thing, but, you know, the goal of all of us who are in this room is to protect as many people as we possibly can, and I think part of what happened with COVID certainly was that it was the first pandemic any of us experienced in 100 years, and it was a novel virus. So trying to figure out the nature of this virus and how to respond to it and contain it, don't forget those tractor-trailer trucks that were refrigerated, you know, storage units in the city for people who were dying of the disease, and we did not know how to basically control it at the time while these vaccines were in development and testing procedures were in development. We lost 400 souls in this county because they had not either had the vaccine or had the opportunity to be vaccinated. And those 400 lives that were lost, if they were to do it over again, would they opt to have the vaccine? To reduce, you know, severe illness and potential death, I would say probably the majority of them would take it. So I think we have to keep this in proper perspective. Vaccines are meant to protect as many folks as possible. And you have to weigh it, I guess, against an individual's right to say I don't want it and go elsewhere or whatnot. But my obligation is to protect as many people in the community as I can. And the COVID vaccination did just that, shy of the 400 souls we lost who were not vaccinated. So for those of us, you know, who have had the vaccine, who potentially even had COVID, but we're not hospitalized and are still here to talk about it, I think we do owe the vaccine that much, that they preserved many, many lives. The reason why the monovalent was now no longer considered the optimal vaccine was because of the bivalent containing a broader spectrum of prevention against some of these variants. And yes, we do have yet another variant that is rising. But with the, you know, lifting of the emergency orders and regulations, really in a week or so, May 11th, we still don't even know what that's going to present for those of us in this community and across the nation. And CDC is still trying to come up with a way to now manage that, including the data and whatnot that we no longer have access to. So lots of questions are going to be coming in front of us again, but I really want to just reinforce our memories of our recent 3 years or so, and I lived every moment of them, that, you know, because of the vaccine, we did save lives. We gave 86,000 vaccines in the Department of Health to people in this community, and I think we did manage to save an awful lot of folks. And again, why do we vaccinate? To protect, you know, the vulnerable, the very young, the older, the folks with immunocompromised, comorbidities, you name it. So, you know, if someone wants to say, I don't want to be vaccinated and then expose a pregnant woman to measles or, you know, is that fair? How about the right to life and liberty of that pregnant woman? You know, I mean, really it's an extensive conversation, and certainly we're not going to come to a resolution tonight, but I do want to remind people that we did save lives.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. So we do have a resolution tonight in front of us. I will just share. I would personally, just so that it's on the table, I would be voting no tonight if it comes to a vote. I don't know, you know, to the sponsor, if you want me to call the question on it, we can see how the votes lie. If it was voted down, you'd have the opportunity to petition a discharge. If it was advanced, obviously it would be advanced. But I just wanted to share that would be my vote, and I'm also wanted to give the opportunity to share that with you before calling the question.
Great. I just have one last question for Dr. Smith. 400 died that weren't vaccinated. How many died who got the vaccine? Is that readily available information?
Dr. Smith, do you have that information?
No, we don't.
Okay, thank you. I think
I'd just like to add that I was required to get vaccinated as part of my clinical duties, being in healthcare. And so the examples that you brought of people being, you know, at risk of their jobs, it's a close question. And I would appreciate the opportunity to look at it and see whether or not there's a class of people that is being, you know, treated, being required to have vaccination for their work that doesn't make sense. I felt that it did make sense for healthcare professionals to be required. This is many years ago. It was a hepatitis B vaccine when it first came out. And I didn't particularly like it because I thought that it was potentially not necessary. But it was protective, and I thought it was reasonable in that setting for the vaccination to be required as a condition of employment. I certainly would have felt that way about COVID vaccines as they came in, because I think that it's really a hardship, and people who were patients of other people have spoken to me about going into their doctor's offices and being treated poorly when they ask about the vaccination status of their clinician. I think that's horrible. I think the clinician should disclose, and that, it, you know, if the clinician is not vaccinated, certainly for the people who are asking, it's important. But I think even for people who weren't asking, there might have been a positive moral obligation to disclose. So the details on this in this realm, I think, matter quite a great deal.
I agree, and I also agree that it's our responsibility to protect our constituents. I was reading the new guidelines, and it's disturbing to read how people are dying from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It's all on the CDC website, but it's not in the newspapers anymore. So to read that guideline that the Johnson & Johnson is still available, people can still take it, and here's the ways they die. Why are we recommending that? I don't understand it. It's still a recommended vaccine. So the fact that it sounded really nice that bivalent offers a broader protection, but Johnson & Johnson wasn't a monovalent mRNA. So monovalent mRNA may have had other things wrong with it that changed. Why did it change? I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. But I'm skeptical of this big power telling me I need to buy their product. So for me, it's about power and choice. And I would love to call the question.
Okay. Before we do, Dr. Smith, because you brought up the medical question, is there anything that you would like to respond regarding Johnson & Johnson or anything? And it's totally fine. All right. I will call the question on this resolution. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The resolution is defeated by a vote of 4-2.
2-4?
Yeah, by a vote of 2-4, depending on how you look at it. I appreciate the stability of the conversation.
Thank you.
We've had a number of hard conversations tonight. I appreciate everyone sticking it out. I believe that was the last resolution. So with that, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right, moved by Stewart, second by Nolan.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Yeah, Tom, that's not funny.
Anybody who would like to stay with Legislator Cochran, they do so.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
I promise they won't always be this long, although I can't make that promise at this point. I have no idea.